Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
They banned him because of Obama. Because of Obama what? I mean, you know.
Because he's president.
He's president. Okay, so Obama's president. So a guy goes out and buys a gun.
Many white guys, not just one. This has been
You know, white men buying guns. Obama's president. Now, what's the connection? I'll have to ask them. Because that's what I would do if a guy said, "I'm buying a gun because of Obama." I say, okay, well, what's the connection between you and the gun and Obama?
In the past, talk of any type of gun control would send gun sales soaring. But in recent months, the long-term outlook for the gun industry has become more ambiguous. Remington Arms, the American gun company that's been doing business since 1816, has announced that it is filing for bankruptcy. And other gun companies may be in trouble as well. Alon Stevens is with member station KUT and part of NPR's criminal justice team, and he brings us this report.
This is your Ruger 308, and these were very difficult to get, you know, while President Obama was in office.
Michael Cargill owns and operates Central Texas Gun Works. It's a gun store in Austin. He shows me around some of his inventory, which is fully stocked. AR-15s, Glocks, shotguns, and that Ruger he mentioned, it's not hard to get anymore.
And now it's great. They're offering wonderful deals.
Because for the first time in years, gun shops all across the country have more guns than buyers. And everything is priced to move.
If you buy six of these, you get one gun free.
AR-15s with prices slashed by nearly 50%. Buy one gun, get free magazines, ammo, flashlights, anything to draw in customers. Across the nation, gun sales are down. We'll get to the reasons why in a minute, but let's see how that looks for the gun industry. American Outdoors brand, formerly known as Smith & Wesson, saw its stock price plunge 70% since 2016. Sturm Ruger, down by 40%. And of course, Remington, a company in business for two centuries, has filed for bankruptcy protection. So what's going on here? Well, a couple of things. To start, there's a glut in the market. Then new products that no one really wanted. And of course, politics. Robert Farrago is a gun enthusiast and runs the blog The Truth About Guns. He says in 2016, gun companies planned for another explosion in sales.
The gun manufacturers ramped up production. They figured this is it. The mother load, we're going to get another one just like we did the Obama surge. We're going to get another Hillary surge.
But that didn't happen. They got Donald Trump. To understand the significance of that, you have to look at the history of gun sales under the Obama administration. Gun manufacturers saw record profits, stoked partly by gun rights groups claiming Obama wanted to take away their guns. Calls for gun control after several high-profile mass shootings fueled sales even more. To give you a picture, the FBI processed 8 million background checks for gun purchases in 2005. By 2017, that jumped to 25 million.
That's a tripling of the market over the last 10, 12 years. That's a dramatic increase.
Jürgen Brauer is an emeritus professor at Augusta University in Georgia. He says it's been the opposite with President Trump. Gun owners have been more confident about their gun rights. What happened in the presidential election shows how tricky it is when companies try to predict demand based on politics.
It really puts quite some enormous strain on you and makes long-term planning difficult.
Brower says that the industry is now going through a correction, but the politics that propel gun sales haven't gone away. The recent shooting at a school in Parkland, Florida, has mobilized students who are demanding action, vowing to not give up until lawmakers pass tangible gun control measures. For NPR News, I'm Alon Stevens in Austin.
This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine. My rifle is my best friend. It is my life.
I must master it as I must master my life. Without me, my rifle is useless. Without my rifle, I am useless.
I must fire my rifle true. I must shoot straighter than my enemy who is trying to kill me. I must shoot him before he shoots me. I will. Before God, I swear this creed. My rifle and myself are defenders of my country. We are the masters of our enemy. We are the saviors of my life. So be it, until there is no enemy, but peace. Amen.
Our poll also reflected a racial disparity on the issue of letting teachers carry guns. People of color were far less likely than whites to back the president's proposal.
When I first heard the idea of teachers being armed, I was like, that's absolutely ludicrous.
That's Stephanie Gates. She's been teaching in Chicago public schools for 25 years. She's African American, and most of her students are Black or Latino.
I think the conversation about arming teachers is different for teachers of color because we live in a culture where we have implicit bias, and teachers of color are judged by the color of their skin. So if there's a situation where there's an active shooter and the police enter the building, how do the police know who the active shooter is? And if there's some prejudgment there, they might assume that a teacher of color is actually the shooter.
Last week, we spoke with a superintendent in Texas, Ricky Stevens, who has a program much like what President Trump put forward. Some teachers at his schools carry guns, but only the ones who want to and the ones who are trained. Here's what he said.
Parents, teachers, even students was saying that they feel so much more comfortable knowing that they have teachers who they don't even know walk in the halls there ready to protect them.
So I understand that you don't want to carry a gun at your school, but can you see the point that someone like Ricky Stevens is making? That it would make some people just feel safer?
So I live in a neighborhood that has high crime. In the summertime, on particular days, particularly when it's really hot, we'll have increased police presence. And also, when there were shootings that took place in different places in the country, I noticed that we get increased police presence. As someone who lives in a neighborhood where this happens all the time, when I'm driving around and I see increased police presence, it doesn't make me feel safer. Mm. It actually makes me feel less safe because when I see a police car on this corner and I drive another block and I see a police car on that corner, it makes me think that at any moment something can happen.
Right. So what you're saying is that the presence of more authority figures in a school who happen to be armed can actually increase tension.
I think it can. Mm-hmm. We know that the research says that children of color are suspended at higher rates, they're expelled at higher rates, and so now you'll arm teachers, which I think would make the environment even more hostile to students of color who are already targeted in some schools.
Are you worried, too, that some teachers might not always make the best decision on when to use a gun?
I think that's a possibility with anybody who carries a gun. And also, if you're talking about a teacher who's armed and an active shooter situation, who's to say where bullets go? Worst possible scenario, I'm an armed teacher, an active shooter's in my building. I engage in a shootout. Who's to say I don't shoot a student?
It seems like so many people right now are expressing such tremendous fear after Parkland. Can you relate to any of that? Do you share any of that right now?
Of course I share fear. I'm a teacher. I walk into a building every day. It concerns me greatly because parents send their children to school to be safe. And I tell that to my students all the time. I say, your parents send you to school, and they expect at the end of the day for you to come home from school. So, yes, it's a fear, and it's always there. But if it's greater than what I do, then why would I get up and go to work every day? Mm-hmm. I have to take that fear. I have to deal with it, and I have to do what I can do in the course of the day to make sure that the students who are entrusted in my care can go home at the end of the day. All I can do is what I can do.
Stephanie Gates is an elementary language arts teacher in Chicago. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
There's a violent hate group with a significant presence here in Washington State. They're called Adam Waffen Division. They have about 80 members across the country. Over the past year, several young men associated with the group have been charged in 5 murders. One member in Florida was sentenced to 5 years in prison for plotting to bomb synagogues and a nuclear power plant. A.C. Thompson is a reporter with ProPublica. He's been investigating the group. He was able to get hundreds of thousands of encrypted online messages exchanged between members. Thompson says Adam Waffen stands out among other neo-Nazi groups.
What they want is different than other white supremacist groups. Other white supremacist groups, they want to go out and stage rallies. They want to politic. They want their members to be interviewed by the media. These guys don't want any of that. They want to be secret. They want to be in the shadows. And they want to launch a guerrilla war. They want to launch acts of terrorism to overthrow the U.S. government and impose a fascist regime.
You were able to get 6 months' worth of this group's private chat logs. What did you learn from those online conversations?
One of the things that we learned about were the sort of details surrounding the murder of a college student named Blaze Bernstein. He was a 19-year-old who lived in Southern California, also happened to be gay and Jewish. The man who's accused of killing him is a 20-year-old man named Sam Woodward, who was a member of this group. And so his words and his messages are in the chats both before and after the murder. And then after Woodward was arrested, his colleagues in the group chimed in about the matter, and they celebrated the murder of Blaze Bernstein. We also learned about the trainings that the group has and how they get together with assault rifles and fascist propaganda and meet in locations where they can prepare for the coming race war. We learned about criminal acts and plans for terrorism that the group has. So there was a whole range of information that we got from the logs.
You also learned that there were some trainings that happened here in Washington State, in Concrete, Washington, near the North Cascades. What else did you learn about this group's presence here in Washington State?
We believe that the cell that's in Washington is one of the larger cells, somewhere between 5 and 10 members, and that the leader of the Washington cell is a guy that lives up by Blaine, Washington, and he is both the cell leader and one of the key top brass within the organization nationally.
You say 10 members, which is a lot for this group, but then talking about this leader who's also here in Washington State, how worried should people in Washington State be? I mean, how do you think the state should react to something like that?
I don't think there's a cause for massive panic or hysteria, but I do think there's a cause to say, hey, law enforcement in Washington, hey, political leaders and civic leaders in Washington, this is something you need to pay attention to. This is a group that has outwardly terrorist, racist, absolutely hateful intentions. They have their own website. They have a tertiary website that has all of their propaganda on it. And they're able to organize basically unimpeded across the country.
This story is part of a ProPublica initiative called Documenting Hate. You're naming and exposing white supremacist groups throughout the country. What kind of impact are you hoping this project will have?
Listen to this. This is an organized, terroristic white supremacist group that worships Adolf Hitler, Tim McVeigh, and Dylann Roof. And I think the concern that we have is that unless the authorities take notice and intervene, that we may well be facing a mass casualty event where dozens or even more people are murdered. So that's our concern.
A.C. Thompson is an investigative reporter with ProPublica, telling us about the white supremacist group Adam Waffen Division. California.
Guns aren't always the weapon of choice for deadly crimes. Blaze Bernstein was stabbed to death, and a former classmate is the alleged murderer. There was a memorial this past weekend for Bernstein, a 19-year-old college student from Orange County. Investigators now say the man accused in his death may have had ties with a neo-Nazi group. White supremacists are only a small faction of hate groups in the state, according to a new report from the Southern Poverty Law Center. Ryan Lenz is a senior investigative reporter with the organization. I talked with him earlier and asked him to describe the so-called hate map.
Well, the hate map is an annual effort on the part of the SPLC to identify and locate the organizations and the chapters of those organizations that profess demonizing rhetoric and hate and extremism across the country, and ultimately to find out where organized hate is most concentrated and most organized.
Now, hate groups in California, how many are there here?
There are 75 hate groups in California. Now, if you look at the map nationally, California has more hate groups than any other state. But adjusted for capita, that's not true. Other states have more hate groups based on their populations. But California has always been a hotbed of hate and extremism. And there are reasons for that. If you look at the hate map overall, hate groups tend to congregate on the coasts and in the south. Mm. And why the coasts? Well, in those states like California and on the other coast, New York, these states tend to have more demographic diversity. And it is in those locations that hate groups tend to target or pop up most, because it's when presented with diversity that hate seems to make a more profound appearance.
So 75 hate groups in California. Is that number growing, Ryan?
California has been a perennial hotbed of hate and extremism. Some years we see it go up by a few. Some years we see it go down. I think last year was 67, so this year it's up slightly. The overall national total of hate groups is down by a single chapter, but we've seen considerable rises in numbers in areas that are directly, sort of politically active. Neo-Nazi groups, rose by 22% in 2017. Anti-Muslim groups also rose. Anti-immigrant groups as well. And these are groups and ideologies that are piggybacking effectively on national rhetoric coming from, come from Washington, D.C. as populist and ethnic nationalism takes hold.
We're talking to Ryan Lenz, senior investigative reporter with the Southern Poverty Law Center. Ryan, we're based here in Southern California, right in Los Angeles. I'm wondering, any specific areas in California where hate groups are most active?
Los Angeles.
Wow, okay.
Los Angeles tends to be the most populated, and I guess that's consistent with the number of yeah. people that live in LA. But really, what's remarkable about California and its place on the hate map is just the number and the variation of ideologies that exist in California, from anti-Muslim groups to anti-gay groups. It really runs the gamut. And again, it's a point that's consistent with the understanding and the analysis that more diverse populations tend to be home to larger numbers of hate groups.
Ryan, what's the history of hate groups and white supremacists in California? When did they start emerging?
Well, I mean, California has long been a hotbed of racism and extremism. Neo-Nazi skinheads have popped out of the punk culture scene there. Anti-immigrant groups, especially in the 90s and early 2000s, when border concerns were one of the prime movers of hate and extremism, they focused on California. So California has a long history of this, and it's one that doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon.
You know, it's my understanding, Ryan, that membership in the well-known hate groups, such as the Ku Klux Klan, are decreasing, but that newer, lesser-known groups are taking root. So how are these new white supremacist groups different in how they do things?
Well, I mean, let's be honest. When we talk about white supremacist groups in the United States in 2018, we're talking about them in fundamentally different ways than we did two, three decades ago. These new groups that are popping up, we don't know the populations of those groups. We don't know their membership lists. And furthermore, it's all been complicated by the arrival of a more intimate relationship we all have with the internet. Whereas in the past, people would want to flock to these meetings that these groups were holding to hear these ideas and get their literature or their pamphlets, now they don't have to leave their homes. So the composition of these groups, of hate groups, you know, especially those that organize and plan online primarily, is much younger than we would have anticipated. And we're also seeing this sort of youth element of hate and extremism pose some considerable threats in regards to the violence that's emanating from these ideologies. There are a lot of young people out there committing horrific crimes in the name of a racist ideology. You know, we would have thought they never would have been turned on to, especially, you know, after 8 years of the of President Obama's administration.
So it's younger and a lot easier to be part of a hate group, especially
Absolutely.
When you got chat rooms. Yeah, because, I mean, before with the KKK, yeah, they'd be under a white hood and maybe you didn't know who they were, but they'd be out there. They'd have to actually physically be out there. But now it seems like you can hide in a corner of the Internet.
Well, that's true, but post Charlottesville, after the the horrific killing of an anti-racist protester in Charlottesville, Virginia last year, this movement of young, active, angry men who have been turned on to these ideologies really made an emergence in the real world. They decided to stop sort of hiding behind their keyboards and to come out with their fashy haircuts, their khaki pants, and their white polo shirts. So, what's most I think interesting about it is that this sort of anger that was pulled from an online troll culture has now become manifest in the streets around us as racists take a stronger stance in defending their First Amendment liberties to say these things in the public square, and those who find them repugnant and antithetical to American values, engage them in these places as well.
What should officials or policymakers do to counteract the message of hate groups?
Well, there's a lot of things. I mean, first of all, like, it depends on where you're looking at this. In the public sphere, I think people, police departments need to understand that these ideas are protected by the First Amendment.
Sure.
But these are ideas that routinely and consistently lead to violence. On a community level, listen, it is important to make these racists know where your community sits in regards to their ideas. Speak just as loudly as they do, and the message will resonate.
Ryan Lenz is a senior investigative reporter for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Ryan, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Keep your eyes on the grass. Hold on. Keep your eyes on the grass. Hold on.
When Reverend Wyatt T. Walker died last month, I paused to acknowledge the man and his lifetime of fighting against discrimination. The pastor and organizer was one of the lions of social justice. But it's likely that outside of certain circles of religion, academia, and activism, his name does not bring widespread public recognition. And that's especially poignant in this month when we celebrate Black history, because Reverend Wyatt T. Walker is Black history. It was Wyatt T. Walker who organized and led the fledgling Southern Christian Leadership Conference that was the organization the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. led for most of his life. It was Wyatt T. Walker who recognized the vital importance of Reverend King's words written on scraps of paper while he was jailed in Birmingham. Walker helped gather up the pieces and then organized and circulated them in what became known as King's famous Letter from a Birmingham Jail. And later, it was Wyatt T. Walker who came up with the next phase of the Birmingham demonstrations, Project C for Confrontation, which involved hundreds of school-age protesters. Project C eventually led to one of the most iconic confrontations in civil rights history, with an image recognized the world over. The photograph captured the moment unarmed protesting kids were targeted with dogs and water hoses. The whole thing orchestrated by segregationist Bull Connor, Birmingham's commissioner of public safety, so-called. Many years ago, I sat across from Reverend Walker with a camera crew for the documentary series Eyes on the Prize, America's Civil Rights Years. I was there to capture his story as a participant in and witness to pivotal moments in civil rights history. As Reverend Martin Luther King's chief of staff, he was known as a brilliant strategist. He might have been amused to know that, according to his New York Times obituary, one Alabama surveillance report described him as the real leader of the Negro movement. Wyatt T. Walker knew his own strengths, but he was not threatened by being an orbiting planet in the solar system in which the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was the sun. As he made clear, he was unafraid to take the heat. I was the organization man, and so, whereas they would not want to confront Dr. King, then I became the lightning rod. Reverend Walker's tough persona was woven into his no-nonsense, no-blink leadership. I won't forget that on the day we met, he greeted me with a cool confidence and a precisely pointed gaze, which automatically caused me to straighten up in my chair. They simply don't make them like that anymore. Reverend Wyatt T. Walker continued his social justice work right up to the end of his life. He was a fair housing advocate in New York City, where he was the long-serving pastor of Harlem's Canaan Baptist Church of Christ. He served as an advisor to Governor Nelson Rockefeller and was a vocal advocate in the international movement against apartheid in South Africa. Personally, I am appreciative of his commitment to social and legal justice, which created a pathway of opportunities for me. And I am forever grateful that Reverend Walker's stories, told in his own voice, will live on in the I series. Rest in peace, Wyatt T. Walker. You made history, and then some. I'm Callie Crossley, WGBH, Boston's local NPR.
Does this to you, like from everything that you've been seeing, does it look like, hey, this is, we
are seen it all before.
Seen it before. Okay.
Yeah.
This is not new to you. This is not like
none of it.
None of it. Okay.
It's all old stuff. I mean, rehashed over and over again, talked about the same way. Look at the Kerner Commission report. You got a copy of that?
Yes, I heard you on Talktainment. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah, well, get it. Yeah, well, just read through it. Just glance through it. You don't even have to read the whole thing. It's a big, thick report. But it's all the same thing. Same thing they're saying now, same thing they were saying in 1968.
50 years ago this week, President Johnson's Commission on Civil Disorders released the Kerner Report. This was an attempt to explain why so many of the country's cities erupted in riots. Now, many observers say this report can tell Americans a lot about the issues fueling racial tensions today. From NPR's Code Switch team, here's Karen Grigsby-Bates.
In July 1967, recognizing that 5 days of rioting in Detroit had left the entire country anxious and on edge, President Lyndon Johnson made a special television address to the nation.
We have endured a week such as no nation should live through, a time of violence and tragedy.
In the same address, he announced a new initiative.
I am tonight appointing a special advisory commission on civil disorders. Governor Otto Kerner of Illinois has agreed to serve as chairman.
The Kerner Commission was established while Detroit was still smoking. Princeton historian Julian Zelizer, who has written about the report's impact, says the president wasn't so sure he even wanted a commission.
He's very fearful from the start that the commission will end up blaming him. And at the same time, they'll say you have to do things that Congress, he knows, would never accept, and he would look bad.
The commission was populated with very mainstream politicians, civic and business leaders, but the conclusions it reached were pretty radical. Unless something was done, it famously warned, America was in danger of becoming two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. It was, says Princeton's Julian Zelizer, a pretty startling opinion at the time, and he says it's still pertinent.
In terms of criminal justice and the way race affects it, I think the findings are so relevant, and you could almost take portions of the report, adjust them obviously to contemporary times, but they would still resonate with what we're dealing with today.
Segregation in housing and education, lack of opportunity, and police violence in communities of color were some of the reasons cited for the unrest then, just as they've been more recently in places like Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore. Much to the irritation of one member, most of the press reduced the intricate, nuanced report to this.
White racism, cause of black riots, commission says.
That's former Oklahoma Senator Fred Harris, the only living member of the Kerner Commission panel.
I was 37 when I served on the commission, and who ever thought that 50 years later we'd still be talking about the same things? That's kind of sad.
At the University of Texas, historian Peniel Joseph says the national reaction to the commission's report was mixed.
Some people really applauded the candor of the report because the report really laid
the blame for the violence at the feet of institutional racism and white oppression.
Not everybody agreed, though.
Others felt that the report was just justifying violence, but it was something people paid attention to, and that was a bestseller for a time.
It's true. This government report by a panel of establishment types was published as a book. The National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, usually called the Kerner Report, was a thick paperback, more than 600 pages. It became a bestseller and was in such demand that 23 editions were printed. Despite that, Fred Harris says, Lyndon Johnson was done with his commission. Instead of the usual formal handshake and thank you to commission members,
he refused to meet with us to receive our report. And that's particularly sad to me, because President Johnson did more against racism and poverty than any president before or since.
He was being criticized from his left by people like Dr. King, saying that all the money spent in Vietnam should have been spent on anti-poverty efforts and racial justice efforts.
Again, Peniel Joseph.
And on his right, he was being criticized by conservatives who supported the war effort but rejected the Great Society and felt as if the Great Society was justifying law and disorder.
So the Kerner Report was put aside. But this week, a sequel to the original report was released. Its conclusion? Widening inequality has become a threat to American democracy. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
Little brother, I heard y'all ain't hitting in New York.
Word.
I heard y'all ain't hitting in L.A.
Word, word.
I heard y'all ain't hitting in North Carolina.
North Carolina.
For 5 decades, it has been illegal for banks to deny loans based on race. And yet new research shows that even when controlling for things like income and neighborhood, people of color are denied mortgage loans at rates far higher than whites. And this trend persists in 61 metro areas around the country, including right here in North Carolina. So why do people of color struggle to get home loans? Well, lenders will say it's about a credit score. But new reporting tells a different story. Joining us now is Aaron Glantz. He's a senior reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, and co-reported the investigation Kept Out, a year-long analysis that looked at millions of government records and found a troubling pattern of loan denials for people of color around the country. Aaron, welcome back to The State of Things.
It's good to be with you.
Tell us a little bit more about, give us the broad picture of what it was you found.
Well, I mean, basically what we wanted to know was, why is it that 10 years after the housing bust that so many people feel left behind? And in particular, why is it that the gap in home ownership between whites and African Americans in this country is larger than it was during the Jim Crow era, when segregation was legal and approved of by the government?
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record. All right. I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay.
Now, I've lived long enough to know that race relations are better than they were 10 or 20 or 30 years ago, no matter what some folks say.
Give them one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
And in particular, why is it that the gap in home ownership between whites and African Americans in this country is larger than it was during the Jim Crow era, when segregation was legal and approved of by the government? Why is it that the wealth gap, according to the Census Bureau, the average white family is worth 15 times as much as the average black one? Home ownership obviously has a lot to do with that, because in America, your house is your wealth for most working and middle-class people. And so we wanted to know who could get a loan, who could benefit from the economic recovery, and who couldn't. And we found that even after we took into account a host of economic factors, race was still there. Race was still a factor in who could buy a home and who could not.
Well, it's a troubling set of statistics. Particularly shocking is the fact that since redlining has been outlawed, the gap between home ownership, black and white, has gotten worse.
Well, it was getting better It was getting better for many decades. Yeah. You know, as you mentioned, segregation was legal. Discrimination was sanctioned by the government. In the 1930s, officers from the Homeowners Loan Corporation, which was part of the federal government, went out into neighborhoods, drew lines around them, and colored them red, hazardous, if they had large numbers of African Americans or immigrants, and told the banks not to lend there. In 1968, after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, we had the Fair Housing Act, which made all of that illegal. And for many decades after 1968, the homeownership gap between whites and blacks got smaller until the housing bust. Mm. The housing bust hurt everyone. But in the recovery from the housing bust, white people have again been able to get loans, but people of color are being left behind.
So the first guess about this might be, well, look, I mean, lenders have certain rules. They look at your fitness for a loan, and perhaps it just turns out that owing to perhaps even for historic reasons, people of color just aren't as well qualified.
Well, we wanted to get at that. So we went through 31 million records, nearly every loan application made in America, disclosed under this law called the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, which was passed by Congress in 1975. And it allowed us to control for a lot of economic factors. We looked at how much money people made. We looked at the neighborhood they wanted to buy in. We looked at the amount of debt that they were trying to take on in terms of a loan. And we found that there were 61 cities, including three in North Carolina, Greensboro, Rocky Mount, and Greenville, where even if you made the same amount of money and you were trying to buy in the same neighborhood and you were trying to take out the same size loan, you're more likely to be turned down if you were African American, Latino, Asian, or Native American. And in fact, Greenville had the biggest disparity in the entire country. If you were black in Greenville and trying to buy a house, you are more than five times as likely as a white person with the same income and trying to take out the same type of loan in the same neighborhood. You're five times as likely in Greenville to get rejected.
And as you said, these findings are based on millions of documents that you analyzed. You used a case study, one case in particular, the story of Rochelle. Tell us about her.
We really dug deep in Philadelphia, which was one of the biggest cities in America, with this problem. And what we found was that really nobody is as perfect as the banks would like us to be. We all have gaps in our employment, or we have cell phone bills that we forgot to pay, or parking tickets that went to collection, or, you know, like life intervenes for all of us, right? And what we found was that when life intervened for a person of color, it was more likely to hurt them with the loan officer than if the person was white. So we feature this woman, Rochelle Faroul, who was just really a rock star of a human being. She grew up in Brooklyn, the daughter of a public school teacher who sent her to a boarding school on a scholarship, where she was one of the only African Americans. Then she went to Northwestern. After graduation, she joined the Peace Corps. She worked in West Africa. Then she came back. She learned how to code, computer code. She was teaching coding at Rutgers in New Jersey. And then she said, okay, now I'm going to try to buy a house. So she was in Philadelphia. The first company she went to was one of these new mortgage lenders, Philadelphia Mortgage Advisors, which makes 90% of its loans to whites in a city that is where whites and blacks make up about an equal portion of the population. And they turned her down because she was teaching coding on contract, and they argued that her income wasn't consistent enough. So she went and got a job at the University of Pennsylvania, where she manages $1 million grant. So now she's working for an Ivy League institution, managing $1 million. She goes, tries to buy a house again. And again, she ends up in this kind of like living hell situation with a bureaucracy that I'm sure many of us are familiar with Santander Bank. And ultimately, after months of going back and forth, a old electric bill on an apartment in New York where Rochelle didn't live anymore appeared on her credit report. knocked her credit score down. And then Santander also said no. Now, Rochelle was eventually able to buy the house, but only after her girlfriend, who was half white and half Asian, agreed to co-sign her application. And her partner, Hanako Franz, she made almost no money. She was working part-time at a grocery store, making $144 every 2 weeks. So basically, the loan officer only allowed this incredible, educated, employed African-American woman to buy a house after her part-time working, half-white, half-Asian-American partner signed on.
Who you point out during in the podcast, the loan officer would continually talk with her and not Rochelle in their conversations after she was introduced into the mix long after the loan process had begun. But the point that you make in this after, again, examining, it wasn't just a case study. This is millions of documents that demonstrate this pattern over at least 61 metropolitan areas, was that if people came in black and white with an excellent scores, then they were pretty close to, then things were probably going to work out for both of them. There's less disparity. But the minute something shows up on the record of an African-American or a person of color, that's when the disparities start to build in.
Right. I mean, nationally, you're looking at a majority of people of all racial groups who apply for a home loan are going to get it. Right. So the disparity is between people of color who have issues and white people who want to buy the same sort of homes that also have imperfections in their credit history. You know, right around the corner from where Rochelle was trying to buy a house for over a year, one of our producers, Laura Starcheski, who had almost no savings and a ton of student loan debt, went to buy almost exactly the same house and was able to buy it in a matter of weeks and put just 3% down. And the bank that she got a loan from, TD Bank, which is a big East Coast bank, they deny the majority of home loans to African-Americans and almost half of all applications from Hispanics. So here you have this woman with, you know, on the one hand, she's educated, she's professional, she has a good job working for Reveal. So she's a good candidate, right? On the other hand, she has no savings and a ton of student loan debt. So there are things that are against her. So they said, no problem, easy peasy, right? At the same time, they're turning down a majority of African-Americans.
I've only got about a minute left, but I want to talk about credit scores here because we think that's a kind of a neutral metric and a way of getting at your how fit you are. But you say there's a fix almost built into what credit scores are measuring that works against communities of color. Tell us about it.
Well, the whole credit score model is really important because when you think about the story that we put out, the main pushback that we're getting from lenders is that we didn't have this credit score information. And the reason we didn't have it, by the way, is because the banks have been fighting against releasing it. They've been fighting against it every step of the way. The 2010 Dodd-Frank Act, passed by Congress, signed by President Obama, said credit score, debt-to-income ratio, and other things have to be part of disclosure under the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act. And the banks have been fighting that law's implementation. We still don't have that. And it's a big problem because credit score itself is seen by many as discriminatory. It has to do with the way the algorithm works. And there are certain things like payday loans, where people of color are targeted for payday loans, that only report if you miss a payment. So, for example, on a traditional car loan, every time you make a car payment, your credit score goes up. So if you miss a payment and it gets knocked down, you have all those other payments to jack it back up again. But on other things like payday loans or rent would be another example, it only reports if you miss it. And so we found that people of color who behave basically the same way as whites in their lives are more likely to have a negative credit score just because of the way the algorithm is calculated.
Aaron Glanz is a senior reporter with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. He co-reported the new investigation, Kept Out. Check it out at our website, stateofthings.org.
The gay rights movement is changing everything. Today, a federal appeals court in New York ruled that, under federal law, employers cannot discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. Gay rights advocates are calling this a major victory and a rebuke to the Justice Department, which jumped into the case midway. The government argued that federal law does not protect workers from anti-gay discrimination. And joining me now to talk through the case is Dominic Holden. He covers the Justice Department at BuzzFeed News. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So can you first just tell us very briefly what happened in this particular case? There was a skydiver.
Right. So back in June of 2010, Donald Zarda, a skydiving instructor, was teaching students on Long Island. And he had a female student, and they were doing a jump in tandem. It's very close quarters, hips to hips, shoulders to shoulders.
Right.
And he had made what he says was a joke, letting her know that she didn't have to worry about any inappropriate advance, said he was gay and that he had the ex-husband to prove it.
Huh.
Well, after the jump, she was unhappy about it, apparently told her boyfriend that there had been inappropriate touching and had used the joke to sort of get himself off the hook. Donald Zarda was shortly thereafter fired. And he filed a lawsuit in federal court. Now, the issue is there is no federal law that directly bans anti-LGBT workplace discrimination.
Right.
So what he did is he alleged a violation of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which bans discrimination on the basis of sex.
Right. So Title VII, as you say, does not particularly ban sexual orientation discrimination. But the Second Circuit here ruled that it essentially does. How did it conclude that sexual orientation discrimination is a form of sex discrimination?
Right. So Title VII and analogous law that applies to students bans sex discrimination, but it doesn't say necessarily what sex discrimination is. It doesn't say if it's sexual orientation or gender identity or a person's sex at birth. So this has left for a lot of room for federal courts to try to figure out what it means.
Right.
And for LGBT advocates, they have been trying to say that they are covered by this law. And in the context of sexual orientation discrimination, what these advocates, what the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has argued,
uh-huh.
and what this court found today was that sex discrimination is sexual orientation discrimination. And it's because, among other things, they would not be discriminated against but for their sex.
Well, how did the Justice Department argue against that in this case? How did they say that sexual orientation was not about sex?
What the Justice Department argued was it was not the intent of Congress to have banned anti-gay discrimination in the workplace. And if they had wanted to, they could have explicitly written it into the law. But as one of the justices wrote in a concurring opinion, that it is not about congressional intent or legislative intent, which is very hard to ascertain, but rather the plain text of the law. And here the plain text found that sexual orientation discrimination is necessarily a type of sex discrimination.
Okay, so give me a lay of the land now. How have other appellate courts come down on this particular issue?
The 11th Circuit found that the law did not cover sexual orientation, but the Seventh Circuit last April found that it did. So part of the significance of this case is it builds on this trend. Now you have two circuits having come to the same conclusion. And part of the reason this is a big deal is because of the Justice Department's own making. They stepped into it, and there's this question about the ability or the inability of this administration to reverse the trend in federal court. So people were watching. So the fact that this is a big gay rights win is amplified by the fact that it's a Trump administration loss.
And let's talk about that. How does Attorney General Jeff Sessions' position in this case fit into a larger approach towards LGBT issues?
Since Sessions became the Attorney General about a year ago, he has been a steady opponent of LGBT rights, rolling back policies and positions that the Justice Department had assumed under President Obama. And generally what he said is he's simply following the plain text of the law. This is a little bit mushy for him because he's also argued in Colorado, where there's an anti-discrimination law for LGBT people, that a baker had a right to turn away a gay couple, even though right. the actual plain text of the law doesn't necessarily allow that. And now he's arguing in cases of transgender and lesbian, gay, bisexual employment that they're not protected. The problem is he's running up against courts that disagree with him.
All right. Dominic Holden is a reporter at BuzzFeed News. Thank you very much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Radford University is investigating a series of videos online showing a student using racial slurs against another student. Jeffrey Prudham says his roommate accused him of stealing a bag and then confronted him on Saturday. Prudham posted three videos of his roommate cursing at him, including the N-word.
Nigga!
I've never experienced threats of violence or racism in my life, and experienced it all at once was very crazy, especially with somebody you live. It's really hard to escape that.
Radford University says it's talking with Prudham about the situation. Radford Greek Life said on Facebook yesterday the roommate has been removed from his fraternity.
Is that a real gun?
Yes, this is a real gun.
Do you kill people?
No, if some guy's hurting someone, I try to shoot him in the leg or something, just to stop him.
Mama says police misshoot black people.
Is it true? Yeah, is it true?
Is that true?
Yeah, is it true?
Is that true?
Is it true?
Well, it's a Facebook comment that's raising eyebrows in Houma tonight. And it's not just what was said that's stirring up controversy, but who said it. Carice Jackman brings us more from Terrebonne Parish.
This post sent to us by an Eyewitness News viewer is causing concern in Houma. At the bottom of this video about a drunk man apparently walking around a supermarket, Lindsay Larpenter apparently writes, N-word, was just trying to go home and eat a snack. Lindsay Larpenter is also the daughter of Terrebonne Parish Sheriff Jerry Larpenter. She also allegedly has a job in the sheriff's department.
Basically, she was referring to herself as the N-word in the post. But however, no one should use that word.
Jerome Boykin Sr., president of the Terrebonne Parish branch of the NAACP, says he was notified about the post by 10 people.
I had an opportunity to speak with Sheriff Jerry Larpenter on Monday, and clearly the sheriff told me that it won't be tolerated by any of his employees.
This isn't Lindsay Larpenter's first encounter with controversy. According to our partners at the Houma Courier, she was charged with a DWI last January.
Eyewitnesses first reached out to Sheriff Larpenter moments after we received the tip about the alleged Facebook comments, but he said that he had never heard of it and refused to comment to the media. We also reached out to him right after doing the interview with the NAACP here at his office, but we were told by officials that he was not in.
I mean, especially if she's in public relations, let's say, through one form or another.
This Houma resident who didn't want to be identified says he would also like to see Larpenter reprimanded. Even if the alleged Facebook comment was meant as a joke,
it doesn't matter. With the way society is right now and the way people are getting along in this country, we need to be more sensitive to comments that are made.
A post in digital media that some say should have real-life consequences. In Houma, I'm Carice Jack.
Every nigga is a star. Every nigga is a star. Who will deny that you and I and every nigga is a star?
Tonight, Overland Park police say that charges will be filed for what happened at this Hooters restaurant. A three-year-old boy was spit on and called a racial slur. And tonight, that boy's family is speaking out only to KCTV 5. Our Rudy Harper is live along Metcalf and 107th. And Rudy, as you can imagine, they're furious.
And Ellen, they are still in shock. That three-year-old boy, they tell me, wandered away from them inside this restaurant, and that's when the crime happened. The grandfather did not want to reveal his identity because the suspect is a first responder, and he fears retaliation.
My whole body just went numb when I heard that, man. How can somebody do that to a child?
This grandfather of a three-year-old is speaking out after police say his grandson was spit on and called the N-word inside this Hooters restaurant.
He's a baby. He's helpless. He didn't deserve that.
Police say the crime happened Monday night around 8:30. A witness who did not reveal his identity but did talk with police says he heard the suspect use a racial slur.
He basically said, hey, get that little blank up off the floor.
The suspect has been identified as a Kansas City fireman. It's not sitting well with his family.
Sick to my stomach, man. But you know what? You got to pray for people like that.
Police have not released the suspect's name, but tell us charges are forthcoming. Meantime, this family is still in shock.
This society, man, need to come together, man, because when it's a child involved like that, it's not right, man.
We reached out to Hooters. We have not heard back. I did speak to the firefighter's friend who says he was with them here Monday night, and he denies these shocking allegations. Meanwhile, the family says they are considering hiring an attorney. Live in Overland Park, Rudy Harper, KCTV 5 News.
Thanks, Rudy. And we will stay on top of this story and let you know what happens and when those charges are filed. You can look for the very latest on our website and KCTV 5 News app.
The Magnificent Seven. They are a cross-section of American men, black, white, Greek, apparently, and Italian. Seven men, seven guards at a county jail in Lackawanna County, Pennsylvania. Seven men who collectively face 37 counts of sexual and institutional assault against a dozen women. The women? The local newspapers have a policy of not naming them, a process that adds to their extreme invisibility as inmates, as prisoners. They were already invisible. How could they feel otherwise when they complained for years only to be ignored, retaliated again, only to be assaulted again and again and again? The trial against Lackawanna County 7 has begun, and who knows what will happen. They may be convicted or they may be acquitted, for they were charged with sexually assaulting women, women prisoners, two categories, doubly invisible in today's America. On local TV, tape was shown of the men being arrested and walked out of the county prison, their hands handcuffed, all caps covering most of their faces. It was hard to tell their ages. I assumed they were mostly young men. But published accounts showed all seven were between the ages of 42 and 53. Mature men, fathers, grandfathers. The sexual assaults against women in a Pennsylvania county jail were no different than the sexual assaults against Hollywood's brightest stars. Because it's about power, y'all. State power, male power, and the power of the law which legitimizes scapegoating. It's ultimately all about power. What will happen? We shall see. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Tutu, a long-lost portrait by Ben Nwanwu, described as Africa's Mona Lisa, has set a new world record for Nigerian artwork, going for $1.4 million at Bonhams International Auction House in London.
It's a new world record of £1 million. Are we all done? For £1 million, last chance. Thank you very much.
Well, Ellie Costello was in the room as the hammer fell and told me more about the painting.
As you said, it's a portrait by Ben Onwuamwu, and he's referred to as the most important artist to come out of Nigeria. And this painting is of Princess Tutu. It was painted in 1974, and it's a portrait using lots of blue and grey colours. And it's a young Tutu in traditional Yoruba attire. And I was speaking earlier to Giles Pepier. He's the African art director at Bonhams. And he said that it's most often likened to be like the Mona Lisa, because similar to Da Vinci's portrait, she's captured in this three-quarter to pose with her eyes staring out of the frame. And all that we know is that it was hung in the Italian embassy in Nigeria for a year, and then nobody's quite sure what happened to it. It went missing for about 40 years. And the theory is that somebody from the embassy bought the painting, not realising that it was an original. It's probably worth mentioning now that the portrait was really, really popular and was made into lots of copies, and apparently you can see prints of it in living rooms up and down the country in Nigeria. So this person probably bought it and then brought it home to London, not realising that they in fact had the original. And it was discovered at the end of last year, and now it's been sold off in London and broken a world record in the process.
Yeah, and there was a special treatment for it at the auction house.
Yes, it was a star lot in the auction, and the room was packed full of eager bidders. It was so packed I couldn't actually get a seat. And as I mentioned, this painting is very recognisable in Nigeria, and there was so much national interest that Bonhams actually decided to do a world first and live stream the auction into Africa so that Nigerians could bid to bring the portrait home. And that's exactly what happened. After about 10 minutes of to-ing and fro-ing, it went to an anonymous bidder for $1.4 million.
And that's not the end of it. They've been investigating this painting and they found something out.
Yes. So I was speaking to Mr. Pepia earlier, and he said he was really intrigued to find the Princess Tutu. Now, she's the granddaughter of the King of Efe. He had 37 wives. So if you do some quick maths, he's got more than 100 children. So she's quite difficult to track down. But since the discovery of this portrait, there's been so much press in Nigeria and in London reporting that Tutu is still alive in Lagos. And Mr. Pepia thinks he may have had a breakthrough.
We met with a lady called Princess Ronke Adamaluyi, and they seemed very confident at the time that they would find Tutu. Now, the exciting thing is I had a phone call yesterday evening to say that actually they had located Tutu. And she is in Lagos, and certainly Princess Ronke told me that they were meeting with her this weekend. So it could be quite exciting.
Yes, so we've had the missing portrait and now Bonham wants to find the missing princess. So I hope to come back and tell you that they've managed to track her down this weekend.
Our reporter, Ellie Costello.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, March 3rd, 2018. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts on any of the audio clips that you heard, counter-racist suggestions, if you have any of your other news items or anything related to white supremacy racism you would like to share. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. A couple things before we get started. We are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, you will see my PayPal button in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email, and we'll get you a physical mailing address. Enormous thanks to all the folks who have supported us for 9 years of the cows. Hope the program continues to be worthy of your time and energy. If you're not into PayPal, you can also support us via our wish list, Amazon.com under Gus T. Renegade. It's also linked at the blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Super, super grateful for all of the support, generosity, concern about the flood, and also the folks who've been just thankful that we've been able to be back on the air and keep broadcasting. Additional note, the iTunes feed did not update the Workplace Racism broadcast for March 1st. It is available at Black Talk Radio Network. It's also available on SoundCloud. Posted it on Facebook, Twitter. If you, you know, have any difficulties or are wondering what happened or if the broadcast even took place, it did. It is available, and hopefully we'll be able to upload it to iTunes pronto. Okay, I have extra time. I was going to comment. Many things happened throughout the course of the week. I'm sure you all will be able to comment and share on some of your observations. I've been talking quite a bit about yoga, right, since my house, my residence was flooded. I've been trying to do yoga for self-care, to just help manage the trauma of being displaced and having to deal with all of this just chaos and disruption in my life. And yoga, it's been great. I did a lot of yoga before in my life, and I enjoyed it a lot then. It's been great to return to it. And just for context, for details, right, so you get a better understanding, the volume is important because I've been spending so much time doing yoga. I took over 45 classes of yoga in the month of February. So in 28 days, more than 45 classes. So this week, just between Tuesday and today, this morning when I went to class, racism, white supremacy, not that it hadn't before, but it completely disrupted my yoga practice. Not that that's, you know, totally a surprise, but the manner in which it disrupted my yoga practice, at least to me, was a little bit surprising, even though we do want to work to not be surprising. I could take up a whole broadcast kind of going into the details of all of this. I'm going to try to make it as brief as I can to really highlight the main portions of what took place in all this. I'm trying to go in some sort of order so you'll have the exact kind of chronological flow of things. So on Tuesday of this week, I believe that'd be February 27th, Tuesday, I take a yoga class. It is a suspected racist. She's the instructor. Even though we'll put an asterisk there, she might be a racially ambiguous person. I did not ask her if she is white. I just, you know, suspected that she is classified, accepted as white. So racist suspect. She's teaching the class. I've never taken her class before. This is my third class of the day, by the way. So I'm taking the class, and she introduces herself. I met her before. I think she was one of the first instructors that I met when I joined the yoga studio, even though I had not taken her class. She was just passing through. So she's going to set up. Other people are in the class setting up. As I said, my code for the past 2 months for yoga class has been I wear my counter-racist t-shirt to every class. That is my warm-up shirt, and then I take it off once we get moving in class. So I have my counter-racist t-shirt on. Woo! That is a story in itself, why I put the shirt on at that time on this day, this Tuesday that I'm telling you about, but we'll have to save that for another day. Cowbell as well. Anyway, so I have my counter-racist t-shirt on. Please respect me like I am a white person. So the instructor, she sees the shirt later on after we've talked. She starts cracking up laughing. She's like, oh, that's great. That's such a great shirt. That's such a great shirt. And she walks off. I've had that reaction many, many times from whites about what I predicted. So she goes back during the class. Nothing eventful takes place after, you know, all of this. Just important to note that she did make note of the shirt. So, man, I'm even having to kind of fast forward. They had on the following day, Wednesday, they had the Unpacking Whiteness workshop. I had told you all about that before. I planned to attend. I went there, and they have on the flyer specifically, which I have about 2 feet from me, they have on the flyer that in quotes, person of color, non-white person, no non-white person who wants to attend will be denied. This is a 6-week series every Wednesday evening for about, I think it's an hour and a half or something, yoga and talking about unpacking whiteness. And they said specifically it's for people who identify, classify as white. And what does that mean? That was the way that they pitched it in class, what this was supposed to be about. So I go and I say, hey, I'm a non-white person. I would like to attend. And I am talking to the owner of this yoga studio, who is a, of course, white woman. I don't have any ambiguity or confusion with regards to this individual. And it's like a lot of rigmarole. Now, we've had conversation before because I had my backpack stolen at this facility, which was a whole nother counter-racist conversation. That's why I said I could do a lot of talking about yoga, white supremacy, my experience this year, maybe another day. So she, it can't just be, oh, you want to attend? No problem. Show up at, it's at 7:30, show up at 7:25 and, you know, we'll make sure you get the best seat. And oh, no. It's, oh, we'll have to talk with the, are you serious? I lose interest once I hear all of this, but I'm waiting it out to see what's going to happen. You know, they might decide that I can attend and, you know, all that, in which case I'll attend. I'd planned to go that Wednesday. I ended up having to babysit a one-year-old, which was way more challenging than anything at the yoga class, but got through that too. Friday, skipping ahead 2 days, Friday, I go to yoga class. Totally different instructor. I've never seen this instructor before, never taken a class. I don't know anything about the person. I couldn't even recognize the instructor. I didn't even know who it was when I got to the class. I'm just going, take the class, get some exercise, stress relief. I'll feel better. I go, the instructor ends up being a white woman that I would say is obese. When I say obese, meaning more than 40 pounds over what this person's healthy body weight would be. I don't say that this is not what they call fat shaming. I have just been talking myself about losing weight. I was in the tubby club myself. But I am saying this. I was not a yoga instructor at that time. It is quite irregular in my experience to have a yoga instructor be someone who is like substantially overweight. This is not one of those yoga classes, and none of the classes really that I've been taking for the most part, they are not the calm and you just get to relax and get a pillow and lie down. That is not the type of classes I've been taking at all. These are more advanced classes. You're doing inversions. They're doing all the headstands and bridges and balancing on one arm or one foot and all this other wacky stuff. So you would need some athletic ability. You would need, you know, some cardiovascular health. It would be kind of challenging to do some of these things if you're 40, 50 pounds over what your healthy weight should be. So that's one. And again, that's going to be very relevant for what happens with the class. So she comes in, racist suspect, the instructor. She comes in and she begins. She says, does anyone know about the Northwest Yoga Conference? And I had no idea what that was. I'd never heard of it. The yoga instructor that I had from the previous couple days was there and seated in my same row next to me, actually. She spoke up. It's like, oh, yeah, I know about that. And she made a foul comment. And so the yoga instructor who was teaching the Friday class, she proceeds to tell us about this event and what happened, major act of racism, and the yoga studio, they've issued a statement on this. I'm just going to read a paragraph. If you all want to check out the full statement, I can put it on my Facebook page or email or tweet, or I can do all of the above if anybody wants to read it. But the paragraph from their statement, it reads, "We are writing to address or perhaps bring to your awareness to an incident that continues to reverberate through many hearts and minds within the Northwest yoga community. On February 22nd at the Northwest Yoga Conference, a problematic interaction transpired involving an Indian woman and a white woman who also happens to be the director of the conference. Savitri Paklavala, forgive the pronunciation, I'm sure I did not get it correct, was interrupted, asked to stop speaking and immediately leave the room, and ultimately the conference by the conference director, Melissa Hagedorn Phillips. This elder, who has been practicing meditation for 35 years, was silenced while speaking about the emergence of female power in yoga as well as the aspects of the modern yoga culture that troubled her. This was an act both of racism and cultural appropriation." I'm going to stop there because, you know, you can read it if you want. Now, hey, she identified the perpetrator in this event as a white woman. They didn't minimize that. They identified it as an act of racism. They didn't say white supremacy, but they identified it as an act of racism and, you know, whatever. Now, when they were going into all this at the beginning of class, I was not pleased. Even with what I just said about, you know, correct identification and what have you, I was not pleased. I do not go to yoga class. I pay to attend this studio. I do not give them my nickels to hear them talk about racism. Let's do the poses. That's what this is supposed to be about. And this is kind of irregular. They generally do not have at this studio or anywhere else that I've been. They generally do not have like 10 minutes of speechifying about racism or really anything political. Like they might talk about, you know, some things related to what the practice is going to be about and compassion and whatever. But I mean, that's kind of irregular to have like a long speech about an incident that you're classifying as an act of racism. That, I mean, you could do that every class. You'd never even get to the yoga. But I'm not interested in hearing that. I think the instructor, your suspected racist, is probably some of your homies who threw this victim of white supremacy out of the conference and asked her to leave and what have you. I'm not interested in hearing any of this. Get to the poses. That's what I'm thinking. And I'm really not that, you know, oh my gosh, I can't believe this. What are you talking about? The first thing that came to my mind after the, you know, just get to the poses, whatever, I don't want to hear all this. Neely Fuller Jr., he, years ago, 11 years ago, he was on Alexis K. Tyler's radio broadcast, and she was telling him an incident where she was trying to support her child, and the people got huffy and threatened to throw her out of the building. And Mr. Fuller said, that happens every day all over the world. Black people are thrown out on their ear by security, black children, black females, black males, sometimes whole families. That happens every day. Sometimes they get black security officers to come and do the throwing out. We, Thomas in New York, he talked about that even at the hospital. They come and roundabout, get out of here, get the broom. And that's all day long under the system of white supremacy. Again, we'd never get to the yoga if we're going to come in here and bawl and whine and cry every time that happens. So that's also what I was thinking, that this victim of racism, she should check out Mr. Fuller to better understand what happened to her, to have suspicion about even the whites who invite you to some event, even the whites that do a whole lot of yoga and say that they're about compassion, even they are suspected race soldiers. So she finishes all her speechifying. We get to the poses. And this is an advanced class. I mean, they're doing, you know, headstands and all the, you know, difficult poses and what have you, advanced class. So we get into it. People are working up a sweat and what have you, including yours truly. I have to give you some of the details just so that you can really get like an in-depth understanding kind of second by second of how this transpired and what I was thinking. So we get into the class. I'm a little agitated because our tubby instructor, and this is why I mentioned that, our tubby instructor is not doing the exercises for the most part. I do not like taking yoga classes where the instructor is not an active participant, where they're just kind of being in drill sergeant mode, excuse the metaphor, but where they're not participating. They're just barking instructions, you know, do this and jump here and stand on here and stand up. You can do it. You can do it. You can do it. But they're just, you know, back lounging on the wall. I do not like that at all. I'd much more, I prefer to take classes where the instructor is actively engaged and they're going right through it with you. Because I mean, a lot of times we're doing very challenging things. So at least for me, it's helpful that the person, they're going right through it with you. I'm not asking you to do anything to do that I'm not going to actively participate in myself. So that was one thing that I was not pleased about. And particularly, it's kind of plantational to just have some white woman, tubby or no, male, female, whatever, have some white person barking orders at you while you're doing something that's arduous. Anyway, so we are in what they call plank position. This is just, if you can imagine being in the up position of a push-up. And this is very, very common position for yoga classes. You'll be here regularly. You'll come back to this position. Sometimes they'll leave you there for a while to build strength. This was one of those times where we got left there. She rotates us to side plank, which is a little more challenging. Side plank is, okay, so you're in that push-up position. And if you can imagine rotating your body 90 degrees, so now you are balancing on one hand. You can pick either one. And one foot and other hand are off the ground. And if you are really cool, you can extend the foot and hand that are off the ground. You can extend them up to the ceiling or do, you know, other cool things if you are so athletic. Our tubby instructor could not do any of this, so she is lounging on the wall. So we're inside plank, sweating, you know, doing our pose, and she goes back to this incident at the Northwest Yoga Conference, incident of white terrorism. And she says, yeah, you know, we have to identify it as such. We have to identify, you know, that white people are causing this and what our baggage is. We have to inspect that. The people who are classified as white, we have privilege. In fact, everybody in this room has some form of privilege. Man, I was so furious at this point. Like, oh my God, I cannot believe we're in yoga class even talking about this to begin. I mean, that does not happen in a yoga class that I've taken. Maybe it is out there where that's where they do the whole class. They just talk about racism, and it's not a dialogue. It's just the person gets to give their view for the whole hour and a half or however long the class is. But that is very irregular and not something that I would want to participate at all, especially if it's I have to be bombarded by a race soldier. Like, come on, man. So, and we're in this really arduous position, as I said, like this is kind of a tough one where you're going to take a little more energy to support yourself, one arm, one foot. So then she rotates us back. We're in the upward push-up position, but she's still going through all this. And yeah, everybody has privilege, whether it's class privilege or race privilege or ableist, everything, all of the trite nonsense that I heard at the White Privilege Conference with Dr. Eddie Moore Jr., the exact dangerous minutia that I told him there, when people are not using correct terms to identify this problem. I don't view this as this yoga instructor is just confused and eats too many donuts. This is a race soldier who is not giving us truthful, accurate assessment of the problem. In addition to, I don't want to hear this nonsense anyway, just go through the poses. At any rate, as I'm in this position, the upward push-up. I'm fuming. I'm upset. I'm trying to think, should I say something? Do I need to stop practicing yoga right now and go into counter-racist mode? Like, I'm trying to process what to do as I'm thinking. Literally, the beads of sweat, I'm watching them, like, drop from my face onto my yoga mat while all this is happening as she's talking. Like, I will never forget this moment in my yoga practice. We move out of that position and I just get a moment to like collect my thoughts and rest a little bit and just trying to make sense of everything that has transpired. I do not decide to stop my practice because, again, I do not go to yogas to do counter racism. This is supposed to be I'm trying to de-stress from all of the trauma and the flood and everything else. Not, yes, let me go into counter racism with the whites that are there and talk to them about white privilege. So we get through the class. I'm thoroughly disgusted by the end of class. Like, I'm never going to take this Chubby Heifers class again. I cannot believe this. And it continues. We get to the end of class. There's a black male to my left, and we get up. I'm like, oh, I try to always, if I can, speak to the other black people that are in class. I don't always get to do it, but I do try to make that effort. Just always cool to see other black folks. I'm going to try to go speak to him before I can even do so. White woman goes and gives him a big hug and all of that's like, oh man, like I'm having to endure a lot. Like their embrace was actually in front of where my belongings were. I'd even held me up and trying to get my bag to get my gear from them. After this hug, I'm waiting. I'm trying to go and get my bag. I still don't even have my shirt on at this point. Important for what happens next. The tubby white instructor comes over and she has a big smile. She's like, I just want to give you a hug. And I just looked like, oh my gosh. Oh, how can this get any worse? Like, how can you go to a class and have to take this much abuse for one yoga class? And I just look at her and she I immediately were like, oh, okay. She goes off and hugs several other people in the class. I just look like I cannot even begin to fathom, you know, all these different things that took place. And then I'm not even done. Whoa. The other instructor from the previous day who was next to me, she had on a Black Lives Matter t-shirt at the beginning of class. She did my number where you wear your shirt that's got your statement about racism. And then that's the shirt that you take off once you get active in class. So she took that one off. We get to the end of class. This is the same female who knew, suspected racist, who knew about the Northwest yoga event before it was mentioned. We get to the end of class, and this white woman begins bawling. I mean, like crying and has to be consoled. The yoga instructor from the Friday class comes over and gives her a hug and is, you know, there, it'll be fine. And from what I gathered, it seems she was crying about the Northwest yoga incident. Maybe not, but that to me, from what I could gather, is what it seemed to be about. Weeping white woman on top of everything else. Like, man, I had to vacate the premises quickly. Like, I was like, I need to leave the yoga studio immediately? Like, oh, I was so upset about everything that happened. This was yesterday. I go to yoga class today, which is with a Black female that I've been to her class several times before. Great class. We don't have a great rapport or anything, but great class. I went today. She also takes up the first 10 minutes of class talking about this incident. And again, I was just fit to be tied. Like, I totally zoned out while she was talking about all that. Again, it's not any disrespect to the victim of racism. Again, it's just my understanding of what white supremacy is. This happens all the time. I cannot imagine having this sort of response to every one of these types of instances, even someone saying that, you know, this instance highlights racism, white supremacy within the yoga industry. Are you kidding me? Come on, man. Like, yeah. Anyway, it just really, there are no sanctuaries, reminding me of the book Without Sanctuary. There are no sanctuaries, certainly not in a Seattle yoga class. At least at this moment, my conclusion is that Tubby Heifer next Friday, let's see you do it again. I plan to be at her class next Friday. Do it again. And this time, I don't care what position that we're in. I'm going to get my breath calm and we will have a counter-racist question ready to roll. Do it again. With that, we'll get to the phone lines. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61. If you would like to participate, if you could take 5 minutes to share your commentary, that would be great to make sure everybody gets at least one chance to speak. If you have additional questions or comments that you'd like to share, if you could wait for everyone to get their one turn and then speak, we should have ample time. If you know you're in a noisy environment and people have a television or other people are talking or whatever the case, if you could use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. You can speak if you raise your hand, share your commentary, and then just mute your line. If you want to speak again later, you can just unmute yourself, but just help us preserve the audio quality of the broadcast. If we could not use metaphors for the broadcast today, there were many metaphors that I could have used to describe my yoga experience, but if we could be mindful of that frequently, race soldiers, they will use metaphors, similes, comparisons, analogies to practice deceptions. They will compare, equate two entities and say that these are equivalent when they are not. They will do this on a regular basis. That is the practice of a master deceiver, a racist. Non-white people, myself included, we've been exposed to this behavior for a long time, and many of us, we are still learning. So we have not come to conclusions on certain themes. Thus, sometimes, as opposed to logic, we will substitute and use a metaphor. And often that just produces more confusion. You just need to say, I need a little bit more time to think to get the logic together to articulate myself. And that is totally acceptable. I do that myself at times. No problem there. But if we could not use metaphors, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt about that. With that, We will hit the phone lines. If first few people who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Good evening to you, Gus. This is Scotty, Black Talk Radio News, Black Talk Radio Network. I don't want to congratulate you on your 9 years, because I agree with you on, hey, if things were all good and this was something worth celebrating, we wouldn't have to do these types of programs talking about the problem of racism, white supremacy, slavery, and human trafficking, and all the ills that we see in society. So I agree with you when you use a word like anniversary. That's like something you celebrate, like a marriage or something like that. I think I heard you in a podcast how you described it. But I do want to recognize your efforts and your hard work in the past 9 years of countering racism through media. I really appreciate the news mix. Being a producer myself, I know the time and hard work that is put into producing the news mix the way that compensatory call-in uniquely does. It may be some others out there, but this program is the first I've heard to incorporate these little sound bites and cultural, you know, sound bites and stuff into the news mix. So I know the hard work behind that. So I just want to recognize the 9 years that you have contributed to the counter-racist efforts out there. I'll be real quick. Loan denials, they mentioned North Carolina, of course, that's where I am. So loan denials aid in keeping Black people dispossessed from owning property. I was reminded of Neely Fuller in a clip talking about keeping Black people moving, keeping victims of white supremacy moving. Don't let them get settled, put down roots anywhere. And although you can know your neighbors in an apartment complex where you rent in, wherever you rent, and you can rent houses too, but you don't own. It's not something that you can pass down as property or build on. So when he was like, keep them moving, man, I'm looking at keeping renting as a way to keep them moving. All right. Because you're on a yearly lease, usually. And we know the racism that has resulted in Black people getting put out on the streets from these apartments. So that's what I thought about on the loan denials. That's a way to keep Black people dispossessed from owning land. The Kerner report, I saw the news coming out on that. Johnson wanted the report to reflect the it's not even a viewpoint, but wanted to blame Black people for reacting to racism, white supremacy, brutal police violence, murder, lynchings, all of that. He wanted it to blame it on Black so-called racism. And the report actually did quite the opposite, and he was angry about that. But again, victim blaming is what Johnson tried to do. And then, you know, that guy trying to give Johnson credit, saying that Johnson did more before, you know, any president before him or after him to combat racism. He wasn't no benevolent act. I want to recognize the power of Malcolm X, Robert F. Williams, all the ancestors, Martin Luther King, putting demands in out there and burning down their property. That's why he signed that legislation. They didn't want their property that they was renting out or whatever to be burned down, which was costing them a lot of money. So, you know, they say violence don't work, but that's, you know, I think that kind of played a role into them. And the last thing, SPLC, I agree with Max Parkes, my co-host on New Abolitionist Radio, who has been mentioning thoughts of them practicing racism. Now, this is supposed to be a so-called Jewish organization. That's how they self-identify as Jews. But if you didn't know that and you saw them walking down the street, you'll look at them, you'll be like, there's another racist suspect or European or white person. So if you didn't know their religious practices, but they are acting as double agents of white supremacy in that clip, and that's a practice in racism. And by them saying that domestic terrorists, white supremacist terrorists, have a right to spew the violent rhetoric that can result and has documented, resulted in violence against black people, and to say that that's protected speech. I don't read that in the First Amendment, what they be citing, that it justifies that, because black people and non-white people, and especially if they Muslim, if they make threats online, if they say things like that, they want to kill white people, then, you know, you are a terrorist, you are BIE. And the SPLC is trying to defend terrorists, and then while claiming to be victims of terrorism and coming out with hate groups. And last thing is, they have been busted, like Max has pointed out in some news reports, for sort of like money laundering, having millions of dollars in offshore accounts. So thank you for allowing me to share. And again, thank you for the hard work you've been putting in the area of media and counter racism in the last 9 years, Gus. Peace.
Founder of the
I'm sorry, Gus. One last question. Your story. I appreciate the way you told it. It was a very stressful situation, as you was intimating to us, but you told it in a way to where I was laughing at times, to where that helps me diffuse the racism, because I'm an empathetic person and I can feel that stress when people tell the stories. But I hope you take this the right way, but ask yourself about the logic of seeking peace in a space within close quarters of racist suspects like that. And I'll mute my line. Thank you for your work.
Oh, much obliged. Much obliged, Mr. Scotty Reed, founder, Black Talk Radio Network. Absolutely. Absolutely. Excellent logical point. I think some other folks said the exact same thing. And typically, they are not talking about racism in that space. That was quite abnormal. If it's just doing the yoga, I treat it the same way I would the gym. But the talking about racism in the midst of all that was, I was not quite prepared. I did not have a ready counter-racist code for that. But again, this coming Friday, try it again, Heifer. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share. I think they said Greenville was the place had one of the highest rejection rates for home loans for black people in this part of the world, not just the state of North Carolina, but this part of the world. Expertise in the practice of white terrorism in that part of North Carolina. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary you wanted to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. It's the caller from South Korea, calling in again for the second time now. I enjoyed it so much the first time, I thought I'd give it another try. Currently, it's 12:42 Sunday afternoon here. And I was just calling to take note of your attempted self-care. I too, have a lot of hobbies that I try to indulge in an effort to minimize the effects of racism. And a quick story, I recently encountered a racist suspect while on vacation, attempting to get some self-care. I went on vacation with a black female friend, and we decided to go to Vietnam. While there, we were motorbiking, we were taking pictures, eating great food, spring rolls, great, everything was cool. And one day we decided to go to the beach. And I'm a photographer and aerial photographer as well. So she wanted me to take video and pictures of her with my drone that I brought along on the trip. I said, okay, that's cool. I can definitely do that for you. Let's move to an area of the beach where there's not a lot of people, so we're not too disruptive, because the drones can get kind of noisy and loud, and I don't like to fly over people like that. So we go to a secluded area of the beach, and I'm getting great drone shots and pictures, and she's smiling and twirling in the water. And And I look up because I like to check my surroundings when flying, because people are interested and they tend to appear behind you looking at your screen along with you, which is fine as long as I know they're there. And I look up and there's this white man approaching me, and he seems to be upset. So he's walking kind of briskly towards me, and he's looking up at the drone and looking at my friend and looking at me. Then he just comes up pretty close to me, within, I'd say, 3 feet, and he just yells. He says, "Is that legal? Is that legal?" And I was shocked. And like you said, we should not be surprised in a system of racism, white supremacy, which is global. But I was stunned. He said, "Is that legal?" So at this point, I just decide to ignore him. So I ignored him, and at this point, my drone battery is getting low. So I'm trying to navigate a drone that's in the air and not crash my expensive equipment. I'm trying to protect this black female from this racist suspect, and I'm trying to get this person away from me. So I decide to step away from him. So I scoot a couple of steps back, land the drone very quickly, and then pack my drone up and kind of back away from him. And at this point, I'm still ignoring him. He's still trying to get answers from me about my drone. And he just ends up walking away saying he's going to call the police, which is ironic because the entire time we were there, we didn't see a police officer, which is good. So we just walked away from him. And this was a great segue with my friend leading to racism. So we were able to talk about how I handled the situation and what I could have done better in that situation. But like I said, it's just interesting that when we as black people try to participate in self-care, we still encounter racism. And like you said, there is no sanctuary. You can be in Vietnam, South Korea, America, yoga studio, gym, boxing, whatever. There is no sanctuary from racism, white supremacy, even when indulging in self-care. And I'll leave it at that. Thanks a lot, Gus.
Absolutely. What was in the conversation that you had about what you could have done better in this situation? What were some of the thoughts about what you could have done better?
I was thinking about answering him, but I knew that if I would have started speaking to this gentleman, I would have became emotional and upset and maybe done something irrational. I knew that I didn't want to embarrass myself in front of this black female who I'm attracted to, and I didn't want to do anything that would hurt this man or potentially get us hurt. So I thought that ignoring him was the best solution. She thought I should have answered his questions, which I really loathe answering questions from white people. And I think it's because if I've been listening to the show for about a year now, and every time I get a question from a white person, I just cringe.
Understandable. White people are very dangerous. Absolutely. And sometimes, you know, it can be dangerous if you think you do not have the correct information, or if you think you tell them the truth and, you know, that's going to result in you being harmed. That happens to lots of non-white people all over the world. You should, if you're able and interested, we would love to have you participate in the Global Sunday Talk on Racism. The flood interrupted that for the past couple months, but we should have that back this month as well. It's always the third Sunday of the month. So this month, that would be March 18th. And it would be, now I am not intelligent enough to do the math quickly, but it would be 12 noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. So that would probably be sometime like Monday. Oh, that might be like really, really late. I'm guessing that would probably be like very early Monday morning, but I'll do the math on that.
That might be around 2 a.m. for me, but I'll try my best to tune in, Gus.
Okay. That's might be asking too much, but Global Sunday Talk on Racism will be back. Always good to hear. Always appreciate hearing from folks who are in different parts of the world. Just to remind folks, really emphasize global system and seeing the exact same patterns worldwide, and how black people in particular are terrorized worldwide, and seeing the exact same way that individuals classified as whites function. Other folks with a hand up, if you have commentary you want to share, lines should be open. Proceed. Are there other folks who had a hand up that we have not heard from?
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, Gus. This is good evening, Gus, and to all the callers. This is Kwame from the Bronx. I'm sure you had a news. I didn't hear the clips. I'm definitely gonna re-listen to them like I usually do. But I'm sure you had a report, a news report about the 50th anniversary of the Kerner report that was reported in the Washington Post. Mr. Fuller, he said something about it on his weekly broadcast about how African Americans haven't made any progress in the last 50 years in home ownership and all other areas. And what came to mind, and Scotty Reed talked about it too. What came to mind was Lyndon B. Johnson. When I heard that, H-Rap Brown, he used to call him Lynchum Johnson, and how, you know, he really didn't care about black people or the issues that were affecting black people during that time, during the 60s, but that report was really, you know, profound and really talked about a lot of issues that were prevalent with racism, white supremacy. What I really wanted to talk about was this week, this black male, his name is Safari Samuels. I don't know if he leaked it or not, or if it was, or if he was hacked or something, but new pictures of his, you know, of his phallus, appeared online, and a lot of black females and, white females too, were talking about this black male and his phallus, and while riding on New York City public transportation this week, I heard even like teenage, black females talking about this black male's phallus, and it was just really degrading and very nauseating hearing all this talk on the internet and in conversations about, you know, this black male and his phallus. And it just reminded me of Dr. Francis Kress Welsing and the Kress theory, how it's all about white genetic annihilation, the focus on the black male and white people's fear of genetic annihilation. And it also brought to mind this James Baldwin quote that I've always remembered, that always stuck with me. The quote is, to be an American Negro male is to be a kind of walking phallic symbol, which means one pays in one's own personality for the sexual insecurities of others. And that's a really profound quote by James Baldwin. And that was really what was on my mind this week. It's like, you know, this black male, he said he wants to be an entertainer, but, you know, now he's just known as just for his phallus. And that's really prevalent in the system of racism, white supremacy, that black males, and we're not known for our intelligence, our intellect, our personalities. A lot of times we just consider just like walking phalluses. And, one last thing I wanted to say. 2 weeks ago, I attended this Black Student Union meeting at my school on Valentine's Day, and I forgot to share, and I shared that on the Cows a couple weeks ago, but what I also forgot to share was I was going through my notes because I take notes while I'm at this meeting, and one quote from this Black female that was going on her rant about how much she dislikes Black males and how Black males aren't this, aren't that, you know, how we are, you know, pitiful, pathetic. And one quote that I forgot to share that I took note of, that was really profound, that she said was, and I'll end it here, is that she said, "My white friends, my white allies, they get it. Black males, they don't understand. I can't talk to them." And I thought that was really profound. And thank you for letting me share. That's it.
That is how effective the system of white supremacy is, has been, continues to be a tremendous obstacle that we have to confront just being truthful. I was even reminded of that sentence that you gave us at the end reminded me of in my view, race soldiers at the yoga studio. They might be classified. See, they get it. They get it. I don't know about this Gus T, but those good folks in the yoga studio, they get it. Those are white allies. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, line should be open. We did have a listener, parent, specifically. They were requesting suggestions, input with regards to their child actually getting recording of their racist teacher saying nigger. They got a recording and were asking about suggestions in terms of how to handle that sort of situation. I think we have talked about that before. I'm not sure if we had a situation where the child actually had a recording of the teacher saying nigger, but be that as it may.
Can I be heard?
1 second, Thomas in New York. Yes, we can hear you.
I'm sorry.
Yes, sir. I guess there are several ways that you can go about it, as is generally the case with white supremacy racism. If you already have in mind what you want to happen, if you want, you know, the teacher to be punished, which very unlikely to happen, but if you want the teacher to be punished, or if you want your child to be moved, or, you know, if you already have in mind what you want to happen, that, I think, can be a good way to go, especially since you have the recording. It's kind of be a bit more difficult to say that this didn't happen, to have a he said, she said, or if it's a female instructor type of a thing. You could go that route. I know Mr. Fuller, I've heard him talk about this situation before. He said that you can take this sort of thing and just not do anything and just wait, because if your child gets moved to a different classroom, it could be that they just get moved to a different racist's class, and sometimes they'll retaliate because, you know, you messed over their friend or what have you. So it might not necessarily put you in a better situation. I've heard him say that sometimes it might be best to just save it, because there will be more acts of racism regardless of whether you stay in that class or you get moved to a different class. So to just save it, and then you can present them all together with whatever you want to do. That's, you know, another way that you can deal with it. Ultimately, if your child is going to remain at that school, there are going to be more acts of racism. So that would be, I guess, the most important thing to keep in mind, that if they fire this teacher, which I cannot imagine happening, if they move your child, or, you know, whatever that they do, if your child remains at this school, this will just be, you know, the most recent act of racism until, you know, Monday, Tuesday, whatever happens next. So to really keep that in mind when you're thinking about what is your long-term objective for your child's safety and for your child's education. If we have parents, would be great to hear your input, because I am not a parent. I had my hour hanging out with a one-year-old. Woof! Both of us were warned by the end of it. But if we have parents, that would be great to hear your thoughts on how you would deal with this type of situation. Thank you for your patience, Thomas in New York.
Oh, no problem, Gus. Sorry about your experiences at yoga class. And I agree with you. I'm not into yoga, and it's been some time. I popped my knee a few years ago, so I haven't been athletic in some time. But when I used to work out, I wanted someone to be working out with me. I didn't want someone to be barking orders. I kind of could see how that would be a problem. I was glad you played Every Nigga is a Star. You know, I love that song. The phallic symbol, the gentleman just spoke about it. Roz had posted an article in BTR community, and it was people renewing their, white people renewing their wedding vows, and you'll see a white woman standing there with a huge AK-47. And I kind of commented something like, this is a Welsing moment, you know, getting married with a big black penis in their hand. Pretty much how she, you know, said the gun is a representation of that symbol. So it's just that phallic symbol is very important. That gun is very important. The president this week, he did say that he was going to take people's guns without due process if they were mentally ill. which I thought was very, I mean, that was, if Obama said that, woo. So but that was interesting. He also wanted to put an age limit on people. Now, this is all talk. We don't know. We know that the NRA is very powerful. But I just thought it was very interesting. To give teachers guns, we had a teacher with a gun this week. Didn't turn out too well. Gun discharged in the school. It's a horrible idea. Especially if you have a black teacher with a gun. These kids today, they could overpower a teacher and take the gun. It's just too many things that could go wrong. I think that the approach that I see in New York City, and it's been like this for some time, and I've seen it take place in other, like I think in Newark as well, the metal detectors, you got to put your bag on the conveyor belt, walk through the thing. It's like prison is terrible, but it's at least you knowing that no guns are getting in. You're taking that precaution, at least to make someone think twice about even taking a gun in. But for some reason, they don't want their kids to experience this. They don't mind black kids going through this every day. But, to me, instead of having a teacher with a gun, have a deterrent so a gun can't get in the school. That would make more sense. And if it's going to be in one school, it should be all across the board. That would be justice. But for some reason, they come up with other excuses. The three-year-old kid being called a nigga and spit on by a firefighter, I believe that's how that little clip went. Firefighter should be fired. He's a public, he's getting paid by a public. That should be untolerated. The city shouldn't be standing for it. The fact that that's not what's going on is just why we're in a system of racism, white supremacy. The Kerner Commission, once again, nothing changed. Every time they put out a report, and then you come back to modern times, you could look at an old report. You could listen to an old speech. It doesn't matter. It fits right now. Nothing changed. And Gus, are you familiar with the NCAA and them using the 13th Amendment to justify them not compensating the players?
I did hear about that briefly this week. Like, I don't know tons of details, but I did read about that briefly this week.
Yeah, I just think that that's, a clear indicator of the system we're in. Of all reasons to use to justify it, they went to that extreme. And that to me is very serious and very telling. So I'm not participating in March Madness. I'm not participating in college sports, watching it at all until they get it to the we get a decision on that case. And I want to see exactly what the case reads. I want to read the actual record, what's on the record, because I want to see how they're even trying to spin that around. Because for this to get this far, that means the NCAA is using a top-tier law firm. This is coming from, people who think they could win with this, using this, logic. So I just want to see how that plays out. And I mute my line. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Thomas in New York. Speaking of Plantational, Mark Emmert, I believe, is the president of the NCAA, the sports division for college athletics. He's the former president of the University of Washington. I think he gets a pretty hefty salary. I think he is one of the whites probably who has had some big part in the decision making about the legal team and their decision. I think the effort to say that, no, we're not going to financially compensate college athletes, particularly black athletes who are bringing in so much money, the basketball and football revenues especially. I'm pretty sure he's been involved. But yeah, he used to walk in front of me. Like, I forgot the number of times that we used to cross paths at the University of Washington. In fact, I was sitting in Red Square. He and Bill Gates walked right in front of me. Like, I could have smacked both of them if I wanted to, and then probably been killed in Red Square, no less, because that's what they call it. But they walked right in front of me. All the time, I used to see him on a regular basis before he switched and took his new post at the NCAA to deny compensation to a lot of mostly black athletes. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we've not heard from you, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Iman DC.
Yes, sir. Greetings. I was going to ask, I'll maybe say a few things, but I wanted to ask you, Mr. Gus, because I don't know that I've asked you, what do you think is necessary to end this system of white supremacy in 1 year to 5 years time frame?
I think it would take some sort of event to get a sizable, not a huge number. When Mr. Fuller talks about a critical mass, I think it would take more people than we have now thinking critically, seriously about this problem with a mind towards a permanent solution. I don't think we have enough black people, non-white people, thinking about this problem seriously, and particularly thinking about this problem with accurate information. It's very hard to solve a problem when you do not have accurate information. And I think the vast number of black people, non-white people on this planet in the known universe who are thinking about the problem of racism, white supremacy, do not have accurate information to begin with. It would take something to get a critical number of those folks with more accurate information, in my opinion.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Actually, that's all I wanted to know. I appreciate it.
All right, on. Other folks, dialed in. If you have a hand up, comments, questions, line should be open. Feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone on the line, to MRDC, actually. Missed you. It's good to hear you again. I haven't heard from you in a while. And to Kwame, I wanted to tell you that your blog is really awesome. It's really constructive. I learned a lot from it, from reading it. You told us what the address was, like, last week or sometime recently. I also wanted to say for the females who were, you know, denigrating black men, I would say that I think over time of them being, you know, so-called friends, excuse me, with these white people, that they've been required to show, I think, a loyalty to them, showing them that and to prove to them that other black people are not a threat to their friendships with them, and that other black women are not a threat to their relationships with, you know, these white males that they're in relationships with. So I think that's why you see a lot of that. To you, Gus, I'm also sorry, like Thomas New York said, that you are going through what you're going through with the yoga and all of that. And for me, I don't want to touch white people at all. And that hugging thing, that for me gets into, you know, unwanted touching. And I have a code, and I wanted to ask you if this is, I have two questions. My code is just not to touch them under any circumstances, no handshakes, no hugs, no nothing. And I wanted to ask first if that's if you think that that's like a bad code and something that's really not realistic and feasible. And my other question was, what's the holdup with you going home? Like, do they know you? Do they know that, you know, you're Gus the Renegade, the counter racist? Are they trying to, you know, sabotage you in any type of way? I mean, it just, if your residence didn't flood itself, it just doesn't seem like it's right that they're holding you up like this. Is there something else going on, or whatever their reason is? You know, do you believe it? So I can repeat the questions again if it was just too many at one time.
Let's see. I will see if I can handle it. You can let me know if I fail to answer your questions. The latter question, forgive the siren in the background. lots of white drug addicts. They could be acting up, cutting up. It's Saturday evening. What's taking so difficult? What's taking so long? The flooding that was caused by a city water pipe burst. That's what caused the flooding at my residence. In addition to flooding the residence, it ruined the septic tank, and that is taking a considerable amount of time to correct, or even to figure out if it's just best to connect to the city sewer line, all of which would take a considerable amount of time. That's why I said the timetable there is not even really a timetable. Like August, who knows? That's basically the way it's been explained to me. Do I believe that? Absolutely. Because I saw the water level over the septic tank and the amount of damage I was witness to that. Yeah, I believe it. I don't think, I mean, hey, system of white supremacy, it could be. They, I'm pretty sure know that I am Gus T. Renegade. I get mail at the house under Gus T. Renegade. So I think it's always best to assume that there are no secrets. But I believe the damage and what's causing the holdup is legitimate. Even if I was not Gus T. Renegade, that would not change the timetable with regards to me being back in my residence. The other question about your code, I don't think it's a bad code. I think might have been the wording that was used. I don't think it's a bad code, quote unquote. I could see where there might be difficulties if you have particular jobs with whites, where I think I've talked about on workplace racism, workplace courtesies. It might be required frequently. A workplace courtesy might require at minimum a handshake. How does your code address like workplace situations where you might have to shake hands with a white coworker?
I just say no, thank you. And I don't do any touch like you always advise us. I don't do any touching on the job. You know, just all the sexual harassment claims, just whatever I can tell them. I just don't want to touch them under any circumstances, and that's why I ask you. Is it a bad code? Because that, you know, in the future could get me in a lot of trouble. You know, if, you know, it's something that's, it's normalized that you at least do a handshake and this, that, and the other. But for me, I just feel like it's not necessary that I touch you at all, that you can say what you need to say to me without touching me. And so, yeah, that's why I asked you that question.
I definitely don't think it's bad. It seems like, at least for some people, especially depending on the type of job that you have, where that could be difficult for some people. But I also think just depending on the way that you phrase it, the way that you explain it and your demeanor, I'm sure that there probably is a way that you could explain that. Just, you know, I'm just not a real touchy person. However, you know, whatever wording that you use around explaining it, and just everybody knows that up front. You speak, let me know if anything I can do to help. Because I think Roz, I don't think he includes the no handshake part, but I think Roz does a kind of similar preface by just letting people know he's just not into all that personal stuff. I'm here to be courteous. I'm here to get work done. And I just don't do any touching. I don't even do handshakes. You know, I got concerns about, you know, excessive touching, and I just prefer to stay to myself. Like, I don't think it's bad. I think for some people it could be an issue in their field, but maybe you'll let us know as you proceed. If you've been using that code actively and it hasn't caused you any problems, if you're going to continue using it, let us know. If you figure out a way to use it and it doesn't cause you any problems, we should be following your code, maybe.
Okay, thank you. And I'll mute my line.
For sure. Give us the update. Workplace Racism, Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Other folks, if we've not heard from you at all, and particularly if we have parents, if you have thoughts about how you would deal with your child's teacher saying nigger, and specifically when your child actually has recording of this event, how you would proceed with that. Other folks, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Hello, may I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, everyone. I know you asked us to the female caller who just spoke, but I remember when I first began being introduced to code and what it means to be codified, and I have implemented a similar code, it's situational. One thing that I'll say, if someone tries to and like I'm not really feeling their vibe, I'll say something like, oh, I'm sick. Or, you know, like just something like that. Like I'm like, oh, I'm not really feeling too good. And that just kind of ends it. Especially sometimes with the men, like unless, cause like men will want to, white men will want to a lot, like shake the hands and stuff like that. And I just feel like there's something very perverted and disgusting about it. And there's enough evidence to suggest that there really is. So that's one thing that I'll do to kind of implement that code with the touching. But I will say too, that I have like a lot of flexibility with it. So if I'm interviewing for a job, oh, it, you know, like, I don't even go about all of that. And in certain situations, I do modify that code and how I maneuver. And something that I've been giving a lot of thought to, unfortunately, I can't pull it up now. There was like a piece of Mr. Filler's book that I wanted to read, but right now is not the best time. But, you know, when I observe white people, when I study white people and how they function, they really have no difficulty with existing in their racist reality and the politically safe reality, or whatever, however it could be termed. Like it's like they exist in two worlds. They're very deceptive. That's actually the more precise way to say they can shake a hand while simultaneously plotting your demise. And I think it would behoove us to be able to shake a hand while simultaneously plotting how to produce justice. That way we can just maneuver on a social level. I'm not speaking directly of whether the code is good or not good. I even don't even think about things of whether they're good and bad. I think it's more constructive to think about things as whether they're constructive or non-constructive. But I do think that something that could help those of us who are attempted counter-racist people is to be able to be flexible in how we maneuver in the world. Not to say that we're accommodating. I also struggled with this, with the whole being polite and courteous. Like I had a lot of internal resistance. Like, why do I need to be polite and why do I need to be courteous? Because I kept confusing being polite and being courteous with being nice and, you know, like actually feeling some type of, you know, kinship or relationship or friendship or amistad or friendliness or whatnot. And so even when I was listening to Dr. Welding, it kind of, I just had a lot of internal resistance to it. But I eventually learned, I was able to really understand that by being polite and by being courteous as a strategy is definitely potent. And one, allowing us to maneuver without attracting such negative attention so that we can get further in our counter-racist mission, but also by cultivating within us an entire way of being that is antithetical to what white people are trying to put on us. So, you know, I'm all for trying out the code, especially with the touching thing. I've dealt with that a lot. If it works for you, please, please, please let me know how to best phrase that. But that's kind of what I wanted to offer. So I thank you all for listening.
Gus, may I please quickly respond to any?
Let's hear it, HV.
Maybe I want to thank you so much for what you just said. All that you said, in my view, was very brilliant, and I always appreciate your commentary from Workplace Racism to every show that you're on. I've been listening to you for years, and I'm sorry that I didn't make it clear that my question was actually addressed to everyone. I always, a lot of times, forget to make that known because I'm trying to hurry up and not waste the time. So I just wanted to say that. Thank you, and I'll mute my line. Oh, and real quick, as far as the code that I have, it's really based on emotion because I'm very angry with white people because of how they are. And the commentary that you just gave, Emmy, was very, very helpful because it showed me of how to be just a better counter-racist soldier. And that's all, and I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if we have not heard from you at all, if you have commentary, questions, suggestions, feel free. The number again, 641-715-3643.
540, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I actually did have a note or two from the clips myself. I'll get them in. I'll sprinkle them in as we go. Number one, the clip where they were talking about black people being targeted for payday loans. That was in the segment where they were talking about North Carolina and how black people don't get home loans and the credit score. This was a part of it. And I said, so black people get targeted for payday loans and cigarettes, things that are poisonous, non-constructive. What other things are black people being targeted for? I was thinking of last week, the community of widows, where black people are targeted for dump sites, any sort of toxic chemicals in Flint, Michigan, where we need to mess up the water. That's what black people get targeted for. What else are we targeted for that we don't know? And then what are the things that white people get targeted for that are constructive that they ignore black people? That was one thought that I had. Other thoughts, I mean, other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, this is the caller from Wisconsin. I just had a quick note about the gun segment. So I haven't read the ICE papers in like 20 years, so just bear with me. But I had one of those sort of wealthy moments at my job maybe a couple of years ago. I was working with an admitted white nationalist, and he was telling me about how he had over 200 guns at his house. He said that he was using them as a retirement fund. So I just wanted to put that note out there. Interestingly enough, he also said that he had a Sudanese best friend and his niece was married to a black man that he hung out with regularly. So, yeah, very interesting. That's all I had. I'll mute my line.
Insert cowbell. How fascinating. I would love to hear Dr. Welzing's commentary on that, just the stockpiling in white genetic annihilation and her equating the firearm with the phallus mentioned earlier. But yeah, I would love to hear Dr. Welzing's commentary on that. I'm sure she's addressed it before in the archives. If not on this broadcast, the Welzing Institute, she left so much material for us to study. And some of that is in the ISIS papers itself. Other folks who dialed in, appreciate that caller in Wisconsin. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, feel free. We miss folks. Seemed like there were hands from folks that we had not heard from. Did we miss any folks?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I think it was that segment where the black child got spat on and called a racial slur. Because I did read like an article on that, and from the video that I had observed or whatever, it was interesting like how the witness sounded like that was a white person. He was saying like how the firefighter guy, like when the police showed up, he went into saying that he was a first responder or something like that. You know, basically trying to mitigate the racist criminal act he engaged in. So, you know, another thing to that point, the way he mentioned, you know, they, you know, can be ignorant because they're trying to make it seem like, hey, since I'm a white person, I can just use any of the various titles, a librarian or a firefighter or teacher or something, And you can apply that to him being a white person. You know, another white person will find that more credible, even when you have a child involved that's being mistreated. So, you know, this guy apparently didn't want to have his identity revealed, the white person that was at the restaurant. So this is another of the multitude of examples of how very intelligent races are when it comes to their practicing of racism. There was another story where I saw a couple of weeks ago. It was this kid over in I believe Portland, and he had just gotten to high school. Okay, he was on the basketball team, so he was saying how his white friends, his white buddies, those two of them, you know, they got taken off for the team, or they was just suspended for a couple of days because they took his picture, you know, and there was this practicing racism. They made this image where, like, they did a Google search for the word nigger, and they had his face, like, on the image portion of Google, like, very calculated, very, you know, very masterful on how they're doing this. And it, you know, it can't be no ignorance. You going to that depth, like, it's like, how can you put something like that together? You know, black people aren't doing stuff like this. And the guy, you know, the kid, he was like, hey, man, like, I went and I stayed to these people's house. You know, he, what they call it, a sleepover. He went to have sleepovers with them, and he's been friends with them since, like, the fourth grade. And, you know, he was just telling them, like, hey, you know, they shouldn't be on the team. I mean, he was like, laid back about it, but they hadn't really suspended the two teenagers or whatever. So I guess they're still going to be allowed to come back on the team. And for that guy who was talking about the so-called hate groups, I believe over in California, was there like a name for that group? He said that they wanted to be like kind of anonymous. They don't want to really be like out in the open or more overt. Gus, was it a name for that group?
That was the one in Washington State where he said they were being more anonymous. If you give me a second or two, I'll pull up the exact name because it was kind of unusual.
And it was like it was interesting how he was, I guess it was the person that was doing the report, how he kept describing like white supremacists as, you know, they just wearing these khakis and they have their hair done a certain kind of way, or they have on this shirt or that shirt. And see, once again, like, they want you to think that, hey, you know, pretty soon, you got to watch for the white person that's wearing Nike shoes and a backpack. But, you know, not to be metaphorical, but it's like they're controlling how they want the races to be, you know, perceived. Like, this is what you need to look for. And I also haven't heard anything of Richard Spencer lately. But other than that, that's all I had to share. And thanks for allowing me to speak.
Indeed. Adam Wafen is the name of the group. Adam, A-T-O-M, Wafen, W-A-F-F-E-N. Adam Wafen is the name of the group, and that's in Washington State. And A.C. Thompson did a report on them for 9 years of the context of white supremacy. A.C. Thompson was a guest on this program in 2009. In my opinion, his most important piece of journalism, also about white supremacy racism, his report on the white vigilante violence after Hurricane Katrina and the levee failures in 2005. His report came out in 2009, 2008 or so. But he was on the cows 2009, Mr. A.C. Thompson. Also wanted to get in really quick. I thought in that report where they were talking about the hate groups in California, the second one, where they were saying exactly what you were pointing out, you know, the whites in Charlottesville, they had their khakis and they came out. I think the term I was saying, we need to make up racial focal pointing and trying to make it seem that these small little groups of white people here are the racists and the rest of us, we are all right. I thought there was a strong element of that throughout that report, really both of them. But particularly he continued in that second report that when they were talking about California, where they said, well, hey, you know what we need to do? We need to speak up. You know, we need to let these racists, we need to let them know that we are about American values and we reject what they stand for. Number one, what do you mean when you say American values? But I mean, really, we're talking about the system of racism, white supremacy. I don't know what is more, quote unquote, American than that. I think Dr. Welsing's anagram, I am race for America.
Yep.
Other folks, appreciate that caller in Florida. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, if we've not heard from you at all, feel free. Line should be open.
Can I be heard?
You are a bit muffled, Mr. Steele. I'm not sure if you're too close or too far from your receiver.
Can I be heard now?
Much better.
Awesome. Okay, yeah, this is Ken Steele, and I wanted to address the question that was asked by the caller earlier about their code of not shaking hands. Was that the crux of the code?
No touching, pretty much. No touching, no handshaking.
Right. You know, I would ask the person who has instituted that code, has that code made any sort of problems for them in implementing it, or has it been implemented at all so far?
Are you with
Hello?
Us? Yes, I was seeing if she's with us. Are you with us, HV, to respond? I think when I asked her, she said she's been doing this. She hasn't had any problems thus far. She just says so, unless I'm just totally victimized and my memory is gone. But I think I did ask her that. I think she said thus far she hasn't had any problems, that she has been implementing this and just saying that she just doesn't do touching and what have you. If you're with us, HV, you can tell me to shut up and, you know, you can set the record straight if I'm speaking incorrectly. Maybe she can.
Okay.
Dial.
Well.
Yeah. Go ahead. Go ahead, Mr. Steele.
Yeah. Assuming that there hasn't been any problems so far, I think one way of evaluating a code is seeing if the code, when implemented, creates more problems. If the code, when implemented, creates new problems, then that code probably isn't an effective code. One of the, I guess, the points that Neely Fuller tries to make in the United Independent Compensatory Code is that all of the codes should be able to solve problems without creating new ones. So that's where you get the whole notion of practicing courtesy and showing respect even to people that you may have contempt for. If you pay attention to some of the more effective suspected white supremacists, they are able to say things like, I have black friends, I have a black spouse, I have several pictures with black people. They're able to operate in ways where they're able to retain their code and their ability to function, even in spaces where there is heavy exposure to non-white people. And I think that is where they are practicing I think that's one way that they practice racism very effectively, is their ability to be racist, be white people, even when they are getting heavy influences from non-white people, even when they're in close enough proximity to be touched. One thing that I've noticed, I don't know if anybody else has noticed this, and, you know, if any other callers have noticed this, then feel free to, add your thoughts. But there's been an increase, a marked increase in the number of suspected white supremacists using the video function and the picture sharing functions on Facebook to attract black people to their platforms by showcasing rather extreme characters on the other end of their political spectrum. So I've been noticing characters like Ben Shapiro. They'll have, I think there was one clip that went viral, this might be even a few years back, where Ben Shapiro argues down a feminist. And I noticed a number of victims of racism sharing this this clip. There's also the suspected white supremacist tactic of deflecting to the abortion issue when issues of racism are being addressed. This is another way that they use to kind of ingratiate victims of racism to their cause. I guess the cause du jour that seems to be really popular is the gun rights discussion memes, videos, wherein they'll have a person who is against guns, and there'll be somebody who has a malformed opinion, or they'll say something wrong, and then, you know, they'll pinpoint that, and they'll say, well, you shouldn't have a gun. And a lot of victims of racism are sharing these memes. I just want to say, you know, the Mark Dices, the Alec Joneses, the Ben Shapiros, they are using these videos to convince you to think along their line of logic, and that is eventually going to lead you to a very openly white supremacist line of thinking that does not put you to an advantage, but you having been massaged into this line of logic will not be able to discern what is correct and what is incorrect. So I just want to caution victims of racism that are on the internet, that are on these social networks, be very mindful of them using issues like the transgender issue, like the abortion issue, like the gun issue. These are wedge issues where they can attempt to strip any evidence of their racist logic, and then get you to think that these people disseminating these opinions and talking points are credible sources of information and logic. Just be mindful that that is what they're up to, and don't fall for it at all. Thank you so much. I will mute my line at this time.
Appreciate that, Mr. Steele. And always appreciate logic with regards to workplace racism. We should all certainly be following logic when it comes to how we're solving problems on the job. And that should be, I think, an essential aspect of workplace counter-racism, solving problems without creating new problems. Again, if HV is here to let us know, just to confirm if she is, in fact, applying the no-touch code already, and can confirm that thus far it has not produced any problems to her knowledge. If we missed anybody completely, you should go ahead and speak up. We have less than a half hour left in the program. Another note that I wanted to make sure I got in. There was a reason that I played that report from the BBC with regards to the Nigerian painting that just sold for a lot of money in London. In that report, they said that this painting was taken from the embassy in Nigeria about 40 years ago and brought back to London. And they didn't name the person who did this, but they said what they think happened is that the person didn't realize that this was an original painting when they bought it and took it back to London. And they didn't realize, or it disappeared or whatever, but, you know, it's in London and it just was sold. Now, I'm speculating here that a white person did this and brought this painting back to London, and that white people are the ones who just got all of this money from the sale of this painting. In my view, that is an act of racism, white supremacy, massive theft. And whites do this sort of thing all the time. And again, the language, where you just leave out details where it's maybe the person did this on purpose. Maybe they knew that this was a really popular painting that would probably was probably then worth a good amount of money. And I mean, whites, they brag about their big art collections and making a lot of money. So maybe they knew, hey, I can do this and hook up. We can do some generational white terrorism, some generational theft. They do that sort of thing all the time. And then they come back and compound that and add to the crime with the language that erases the original act of white supremacy, white terrorism. Any folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary, proceed.
Gus, should I go ahead and answer the question now?
Yeah, because you can probably do that quickly.
Okay. I just wanted to say, yes, I have implemented it. I haven't had anyone try to hug me or touch me since implementing that. However, what has happened is that people that I used to hug in social settings and things like that, they noticed a difference where I wasn't doing any of that. And they became immediately alarmed and started asking me what's wrong and a bunch of questions and things like that. But in terms of like being fired from a job or anything, you know, beyond what I just said, I haven't had any problems as of yet. So I'll mute my line.
Workplace Racism, Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Any folks that we missed completely have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Roz.
Greetings to you guys. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. Yeah, there was two things I wanted to touch on. The first thing had to do with what the previous caller brought up about their code, as well as Emmy. I wanted to start with a brief article that I think will kind of lead into my commentary on that. So this is from BlackThen.com, The Lynching of Edward Coy, Torched by His White Sweetheart. Edward Coy was a 32-year-old African-American man who was burned at the stake in Texarkana, Miller County, before a crowd of approximately 1,000 people. Journalist Ida B. Wells and prominent anti-lynching crusader from Memphis, Tennessee, described Coy's murder as one of the most shocking and repulsive in the history of lynching. Coy, described by the media as quote-unquote mulatto, was charged with a crime from which the laws provide adequate punishment. He was charged with assaulting Miss Julia Henry Jewell, a white woman. A mob pronounced him guilty, strapped him to a tree, chipped the flesh from his body, poured coal over him, and set him on fire. Coal oil, excuse me, over him and then set on fire. At that time, the New York Times reported Jewel was attacked and raped by a Negro, quote unquote, who visited her house to sell hogs to her husband. The man allegedly attacked her husband, left home and went out of town. Mobs scoured Texarkana, searched for the suspect. Two black men were apprehended, but those two were declared innocent by Julia Jewel. During the search, it was learned that the suspect being sought was named Ed Coy. It was believed that Coy had fled northwards towards Little River County, Arkansas. Another suspect was arrested and brought before Jewel, who quote unquote pronounced him not the man, although the hat and clothes he wore looked exactly like those of her assailant, unquote. The prisoner explained the clothing by saying that, quote, he and Coy had been together on Sunday and Monday, at the latter's request, they had swapped clothes. Coy said that they were after him for some minor offense, unquote. The next morning, farmer W.B. Scott, who lived just 5 miles outside of Texarkana, found Ed Coy and held him until a posse led by Noah Sanderson arrived and took possession of Coy. The posse, consisting of about 50 mounted guards, quote, attended the prisoner to town, arriving about 9 o'clock, unquote. Jewel identified Coy as the man who attacked her. By 2 p.m., the decision had been made to hang Coy. A crowd of 1,000 marched Coy to Iron Mountain Roadhouse. The crowd yelled, "Burn him, burn him." Julia Jewel was given a torch. She looked at Coy, looked at the torch, and seemed to falter until a person in the crowd yelled, "Burn him." She applied the torch, and the crowd watched Coy burn alive. Coy contended right up until his death that he and Jewel were lovers by, quote, mutual desire and consent, unquote. As she applied the torch to his oil-soaked body, he turned to her and asked her how she could burn him after they had been, quote, unquote, sweethearts for so long. And therein lies the one of the practices that white people do. That's where they use courtesy and niceness to disarm black people psychologically. And these are the types of things that can happen. That's why I always say that when I use the term white female, I always spell it F-E-E-M-A-L-E. Because when you mess with a white female in any capacity, they're going to make you pay. It could be with your life. It could be with going into slavery on the prison plantation, the destruction of your character and reputation. But they're going to make you pay. Now, Dr. Ben used to tell us stories about with the Italian invasion in Ethiopia, when he that he knew about, being that he was born there, and that the Ethiopian women, to avoid being raped by the Italian soldiers, would jump off of cliffs screaming the name of Yahweh on their way down to their death. And in certain parts of East Africa, there were stories where African women would actually play the role of trying to sexually satisfy Arab invaders, and when getting them in the bedroom, they would slit their throats. So there is different ways that being courteous can be used to disarm white people the way that they disarm us. Because it's not in our character to be facetious and murderous, we don't tend to think of things that way. But you can always get past people's defenses by being more courteous and seemingly quote-unquote nice. And I think that there are many examples that in history that we can use to facilitate that sort of behavior. When I ever have to shake white people's hands, and I don't like it either because I just think they're filthy germ factories. They've always used things like blankets, and they'll present them to you in a seemingly nice manner that are infested with diseases and smallpox. So when I shake white men's or any woman, white person's hand, period, I carry colloidal silver in a gel form that I use the way that people use hand sanitizer. It's a lot safer, and it does not destroy your immune capacity. So that's something that I carry with me everywhere, and I utilize it if I have to touch them or anything that they've touched. Also, I wanted to find out more information about the parent whose child taped his teacher saying nigger. I wanted to know the context. Was it something where they were teaching a class? Let's say a history class on slavery, and that's the context in which it came. Was he actually using it against the child as far as on a personal level, calling that child out of their name? Also, I wanted to know what state they were in, just to find out what the laws are as far as recording conversations. Also, if there were any other witnesses that could corroborate the recording as well, simply because that way you might be able to facilitate dealing with this through the Board of Education, the superintendent, or even making it a legal matter, depending on the context. And since I don't have that information, I can't say. But if you do have or live in a state where there are laws where you can record, as far as one party recording, as long as one person involved in the situation is aware that they're recording, which would be the person recording, that it's legally viable for them to record and use that in a court of law. If not, then I would use it to transcribe what happened and see if there were other witnesses that could corroborate what was said in case the recording cannot be used legally. That would be my suggestion. As far as the last thing would be the comment on guns in schools, I could just see that being a complete nightmare. I don't see black teachers doing that at all, just for the reasons that Thomas in New York so brilliantly elucidated. But I could see white people looking at a black child who they couldn't stand because they're white supremacists, saying that they felt fearful and literally shooting them and basically doing a George Zimmerman stand your ground law. I thought the black male was gonna hurt me, so I shot and killed him. Or even if there was an event at the school, let's say, where someone was shooting and the teacher decided to use their weapon, all of a sudden they accidentally kill a black student or multiple black students. So that, I think, is something else we should look at as far as just white people using these situations to their advantage in order to take advantage of and kill our people and our children. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Mr. Reed. Did we have other folks? We are almost at the end. Other folks that we missed completely. Appreciate that, Roz. Sorry, appreciate that, Roz. Do we have any other folks that we missed completely?
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings. With the touching situation, I'm not a touchy-feely type of person myself. I do have a code, but it's not very structured. I would say, though, that for the most part, there's insincerity out of a lot of people with that type of procedures anyway, white and non-white. I've seen where white people would kiss someone before they kill them. If anybody's seen The Godfather, and I know that happens in real life, although Godfather wasn't real, but it's a real life movie, and I do believe that it actually happens in real life. And white people also do that with the handshake, and basically to get their victim to confirm with them that what the mistreatment that they're doing to that non-white person is okay. So they stick their hand out for you to shake it. Most times we have to do it because if we don't do it, we'll get that job, or we won't get that raise. And as I mentioned before, with non-white people who we realistically have been trained by racists, we've been trained to dislike ourselves, and therefore we dislike a reflection of ourselves, which is another non-white person. I've seen where we are hugging and slapping five and all of that kind of stuff, and the next moment we are cussing each other out also fussing and fighting and even get to killing one another. So for the most part, that type of communication or interaction is not constructive anyway. So I minimized it actually from that standpoint. What I was calling for was this. Even before the Parkland incident, I had been hearing, and it's almost like a cliche, to as an answer to quote unquote gun control, and I'm going to just quote it: if black people would go and register for firearms, then gun control will automatically take place. Now I would assume that that's being said, and it sounds. Something popular, something like that. And I assume the reasoning with that is that with a lot of non-white black people getting guns, it would frighten white people. Well, everything that comes in my mind, I've learned to question it, even things that sound like it's right. I'm not sure that that's a correct thought. It's a cliche, but it's not. I don't even think that may not be correct thought. I don't think white people are afraid of us having guns. Minister Farrakhan, a clip of Mr. Farrakhan years ago, was on record that state the white man gives you a gun because he knows you're not going to shoot him. And for the most part, I think that statement is correct, what he said. And now, who are we going to harm with those guns? Primarily, well, we have harmed each other with firearms. The ones that those of us have now, legal and or quote-unquote unlegal, we have done the job for the most part harming each other. So that's just a thought. I think it's popular enough that probably a lot of people have heard that I don't know if you want to call it a anecdote or whatever, but I've heard it quite a bit even before, like I say, even before the Parkland incident. It's just a thought of mine, and I really needed to have been to be able to say it at the beginning of the program, so maybe listeners can kind of like deal with it. But anyway, I said it anyway, and that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Is there anybody that we missed completely who had a hand up, who had commentary that we've not heard from at all? Anybody we missed completely?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how's it going? I have a couple incidents. One is a workplace racism incident, and I wanted to comment about some of the clips that we heard. So I work in the technology field and airplane maintenance, and currently at my job, there's been an influx of racist incidents, and just the general atmosphere of the workplace has deteriorated. There are only two Black people on my team of over 300 or 400. And a lot of these would be so-called liberal whites. So in terms of the way they act, it's very covert and refined. But despite a lot of them being liberal and half the department being also conservative, they both work together to undermine Black people regularly. They will serve to withhold information that is relevant for the job and the safety of passengers. One thing I've noticed is that whites will purposely undermine multi-million dollar pieces of equipment in order for you as a Black person so you don't gain relevant knowledge. And, you know, the types of knowledge that will make you very good at your job and possibly smarter and or better at them at the same job, they will withhold certain information. And they do it purposely with no regard for the piece of equipment or the people's lives that could be in the mix of metaphor. But so currently we are seeking some legal advice just because of the situation. And it's gotten so bad that multiple non-white people have left the workplace. And they're losing senior level non-whites, you know, people who hold relevant positions. And without that manpower, there's definitely a drop in quality. I wanted to say that. And I wanted to comment about the shooting, the clips about gun control. One thing I noticed with whites and guns is that they have a certain access to weapons that your average Black person, even if you were to go to a gun shop, you still couldn't get access to. And I think that at a lot of these stores, they have, because, you know, there's the AR-15, but the AR-15, they're guns that can do what the AR-15 does and more. And I know whites with these types of guns. And if you ask them where they're getting this stuff, because I like to ask them questions, they have a cousin or a friend or a brother who's former military or is a cop, and they're getting, like, literally military-grade weapons, scopes that can see 2 or 3 miles away, with laser dots, and these are like 22, 23, 24-year-old whites. So the gun culture starts at a young age with whites, and their general psychotic behavior just tends to make the situation worse, in that many people's lives are lost because of them being psychotic and their obsession with weapons and guns. And it just ends up hurting many people. But that's all I have for them.
Context of white supremacy. Your workplace situation that you described at the beginning, extraordinarily traumatic. It sounds like that might be the plan. Racists do that from time to time. They might be carrying out their own purge. That movie has been on my mind a lot, even though I haven't seen it recently. But they could have been carrying out their own purge. Like, you know, we'll just make things really, really bad and mess things up. And we talk about that on workplace racism a lot, withholding training or withholding constructive information so that they'll make errors or they won't be proficient at their job, even if that means we're messing the bottom line up or messing up equipment or what have you. Oh, well, or endangering, you know, the safety of others. Oh, well, racism, white supremacy trumps all. Like, we've seen that pattern on a pretty consistent basis, but that might be a part of the pattern that will drive these niggers so crazy that even the ones that we've allowed to accumulate a few nickels will just get frustrated and, you know, say, I got to find another plantation. That might be a part of their plan. I think that is something that racists do on the job from time to time, just say that we'll just really intensify our terrorism and see if we can make, you know, 45%. They might be real scientific about it. We'll see if we can terrorize them and get 45% of them to quit by, you know, June. Workplace Racism, Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Certainly dial in to update us if this is ongoing. I think you said you all might seek legal counsel and different strategies about how to deal with this. Might even be worthwhile to give Mr. Fuller a jingle, see if he has a suggestion or two about how to proceed using some counter-racist logic. Mr. Edward Williams might even have a thought or two as well. Anybody, anything they need to get in 20 seconds or less? We'll take one person. Anybody, anything they need to get in 20 seconds or less?
Can I say something?
20 seconds or less.
Yes, sir. I want to say to the person whose kid with the nigger, they should get a lawyer, take their kid out to school. That's probably what that lawyer would advise you to do. And say your kid's been traumatized and distressed. And that kid should, you do definitely have a case if you got it on tape. Last 10 seconds, I guess, the no touch, I practice deception. I think white people practice deception, so I do the same thing. So I have no problem shaking a white person in the hand, smiling in their face, knowing the whole time that they're my enemy because they do it to me. I mute my line.
Appreciate that. That will wrap us for this week. We will be here. We should be here on Wednesday. It should be posted on Black Talk Radio Network, the Facebook page. It will be widely available. If you get confused, you could drop an email at untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. Hopefully the iTunes feed will update, but certainly today's broadcast and all the other broadcasts from this week, it's available at SoundCloud, Black Talk Radio Network, and other outlets. But hopefully iTunes will load and it'll be available all the places that it normally is. With that, if you have questions, guest suggestions, input, thoughts, gripes, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. If it's workplace racism, I'd prefer if you do an email just because Facebook, it's easier for me to organize messages via Gmail. And if it's a workplace racism or something of that nature, I have like folders so that I can kind of keep track of things. And I don't have all of that on Facebook. So if it's, you know, workplace racism, guest suggestion, it would be better if you could send those types of things to the email account, untiljustice@gmail.com. Much obliged. I will post on Facebook tomorrow for the upcoming book. I think I've made a decision, but I will sleep on it one night and we'll be ready to roll. Book Club will be back this Friday. With that, I will certainly encourage sobriety would be best. I think we heard in the sound clip that the sheriff's daughter was caught. She made some sort of social media post where she, I think, self-referenced, calling herself a nigger, I think, in the post. And people were saying she should be reprimanded and what have you. What stood out to me in that clip was, beyond her calling herself a nigger, was that they said she had a DWI, but she still got a job working at the police department. I think for a whole lot of black people, we would not have the same outcome. DWI might be the end of our, you know, any sort of having a great career, getting a DWI and everything that that might entail for a black person. Sobriety would be best.
race soldiers. They have done a lot of damage against non-white people. When we are under the influence and not able to think correctly, Dr. Welsing, Dr. Kanban, Dr. Ben, I think many of the folks that we revere, they would strongly encourage, hey, let's leave all of those narcotics, poisons alone. Let's preserve our brain computers so we can make the best possible decisions to solve this problem immediately. You do not want to be in a vehicle with Daniel Holtzclaw, any other race soldier, the day that they pull you over and have that be the time that you are under the influence, driver or passenger, even as a pedestrian. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.